House Civil Law Committee will come to order.
We got to do minutes.
Okay, we have a motion for minutes on Friday, March 14th. Representative Liebling moves the minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. First bill is Representative Liebling's 1971 Automatic External Defibrillator Registration Provided. Representative Liebling moves that House File 1971 be referred to the General Register. There is an author's amendment labeled A2. In order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have a DE1 amendment that's in the packets, and that's the amendment that I'd like to move on. Frankly, not sure what the A1 is.
Well, it's A2 is what we just passed. Representative Liebling moves reconsideration of the A2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So you've got the DE1 amendment. We'll vote on the DE1 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. Members, all in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, to your bill as amended, the DE1 amendment.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, the DE1 amendment really cleans up the bill and tightens it up quite a bit and resolves some kind of issues about how it would really work. Members, this is a really important bill, even though it's kind of a small, narrow issue, but it's really important to the health of Minnesotans. And this deals with those automatic external defibrillation machines. Hard word to say. Probably most of us say it wrong. I do most of the time. But anyway, these are those things you see in a public place that if you have a sudden heart attack, which kills a lot of people, that somebody might be able to revive you or your loved one by using one of these machines. Well, the problem is that sometimes these machines are not actually in working order. And so I think almost worse than not having one of these when you need it would be having one that the batteries are dead or having one that for one reason or another it doesn't function. So that's what this bill is about, making sure that if people choose to have one of these accessible to the public for public use like in a shopping mall or here in the state office building, that there's some hope that the thing is being kept or some program to remind the owner to keep it up to date and make sure that that's happening. So I'm going to turn this over to my testifier and let him go through and explain kind of what this committee needs to know about how the language has been tightened, and I hope that this, you know, won't pose any. I don't think it really has the kind of data issues that we usually deal with in this committee, but we'll see what you all think.
Mr. Bell, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Bell. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association of Minnesota, and thank you very much, Representative Liebling, for not only authoring this bill, but for helping us make sure that we can work out some of the kinks that we had in between the two committee stops. And thank you, Chair Lesh and Emily and Matt Bergeron from the HHS Policy Committee. After we had our first hearing, there were some concerns from members of the business community, and we were able to sort of work all those out and work through those details. And the DE1 amendment goes through sort of the compromise for all of those. So what I'd like to do is just really quite quickly walk through the 11 things that changed from the initial bill, and if I can we can take questions on what some of those are.
When you say quickly walk through 11 things, that doesn't sound like quickly to me, Mr. Bell. So, I tell you what, this to me, I think this is a non-controversial bill. Am I right, members? Or anyone has major questions? Representative Howe has a question. Why don't we just, if it's all right with you, I'll say, Mr. Bell, let's move to questions. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I read the letter here that looks like they've implemented Mr. Paul Mendoza has implemented a program that on his own without statute, without law, that looks like it's pretty successful. I know in my own community, in the local rural fire department, we go into all those public buildings and we see one that's got a problem because we look at them every time we're in those buildings and we notify the owner they get fixed. Why do we need statute? Why do we need to do this to fix a problem that I don't think is very widespread and can be handled by the fire department associations, by the fire chiefs association, and the paramedic association?
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, yes, there are excellent programs that are out there, and there are people that are doing these. The reason for the bill was the concern that there seems to be a growing number of instances where we do find AEDs in public that aren't maintained at all. The other letter that you have in your packet from Dale Wakasugi, who's another representative in that industry, estimates that in Minnesota, roughly one in five of the AEDs he comes across in public has not been maintained. And Mr. Mendoza talks about he runs into AEDs on a regular basis that aren't maintained. So the goal of the bill was simply to require that if you have an AED that's meant for public use, it has to be entered in some sort of a maintenance program.
Representative Howe.
So the only question I really have then is, where's the teeth in the law? If I don't register the AED because it's another requirement that I've got to assign an employee to do, am I just held liable if it's not, so I can get sued by the person that has a a heart attack, the simple one, has the heart attack and dies? So now who's held liable? Is it because I know there's a ton of these out there that were purchased by organizations and donated to these public places. So now is the city, is the public employee, is he who's running the local ice arena going to be held liable for not maintaining it and failing to register it? Who's on the hook here?
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that these are actually for cardiac arrests, which are not the same as a heart attack. A heart attack is a plumbing issue. A cardiac arrest is a heartbeat electrical issue. Because of who I work for, I have to say that. If you look at the DE1 amendment, if you check out line 3.7, that's some of the language that was added. There's no intention with this bill to increase any liability that's already out there under common law or the common standard of care. And we do have the attorney that drafted that particular language is here to ask questions. The teeth of the bill, to get to your original question, is that one of the public safety agencies in the bill has the authority to order you to take it down. Our goal was always that if you're not going to be able to maintain it and you're not willing to commit to a maintenance program to maintain it, we prefer that you take it down so it's not providing a false sense of security.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair. I'm probably one of the few people in this room that actually have used one. I actually do have a, except for Mr. one of the few, but I actually do have saves on it, and it's a very good piece of equipment. My concern is I've had mine, the one that I had in my squad car, was maintained on a Friday. The following weekend, the battery was dead and it had not been used. Just sometimes the maintenance doesn't work. And they malfunction. I think with this bill, it's a possibility where it's a mechanical malfunction, where it was the maintenance was done on it one day and it malfunctions after the maintenance. In fact, mine was when I did the test, it malfunctioned, the battery no longer worked. So I think just general maintenance and the organizations in my community that have these, they are maintaining them regular. They are actually keeping logs. The fire department from my one of the fire departments that's involved in this, they go around monthly and double check these things and keeping records. So I think this is somewhat unneeded. And with the register, what is the cost and who is going to be maintaining these registers? I noticed that there doesn't appear to be any fiscal notes on these. And there is going to be some cost involved in this, and I guess those are some answers that we're going to need to know as well.
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have another testifier available. They can talk more about the registries, but just the general answer is there's a lot of different options for registries, and a couple of the registries that are listed in the bill as possibilities are free registries. The National AD Registry and the Minnesota AD Registry operate on a computer system that sends automatic reminders via email and robo-phone call.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Paul Mendoza is one of my partners. Worked with him for 25 years. He's a good paramedic. He's a good man. And what he's doing is he's doing a good job. My question, I'm acutely AEDs, these things, the very first models that came out, they looked like car batteries and everyone hated them. They've come a long way and they do a good job. My question is, when you have a when you have this registry built, my fear is that we will begin to pick and choose winners and losers as to who gets the business for replacing replacing the batteries or replacing the pads. These are expensive. My church recently got an AED because I twisted enough elbows because we need one. And there are different manufacturers out there. My question is how do we make sure that there's a is there a built-in protection that that doesn't pick winners and losers when it comes to purchasing these replacement pieces that are needed?
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, we never had any sort of intention of choosing winners or losers. There's lots of manufacturers out there. There's lots of examples of different ways to comply with registering your AED. It's not something that we contemplated. The choices are out there. I don't know how the bill would push someone to one or the other, but we'd certainly be up for any suggestions on how we could make sure that it doesn't push somebody to a specific manufacturer.
President Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is kind of related to Representative Neuberger's question. Is who has access to these lists of the AED owners or where they're placed? Is that all public record? Or, like, the people that have them privately, is that also on the registry? And is that public? You know, if I have one in my home, is that public knowledge? And secondly, go ahead and answer that question.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Scott, I think that question would best be answered by Kim Harkins from the Resuscitation Consortium, who knows more about how the registries actually work.
Well,
and she is available.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
In the meantime, I'd just like to point out on line 2.31 and 2.32, it says that the owner of a private use AED is not subject to the requirements. So that answers at least part of the question.
Okay, thanks. Representative Scott?
I guess they have another person coming. I just want to know who has access to the public.
Okay. With the testifier, please introduce yourself and answer Representative Scott's question.
My name is Kim Harkins. I'm from the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium at the U of M. The registries, there are several out there, and most of those registries, their information is kept only between the AED owner and the registry. Some of them, for example, the National AED Registry, we work with them through a partnership through the Department of Health. So we do have access to those, but we don't share them with the public. We use them only for looking at data around cardiac arrest to see where AEDs are in relation to where cardiac arrests are happening. If any information is ever shared to public service agencies such as police and fire, it is without specific data. It's just location of AEDs so that they can be part of their community service and knowing where AEDs are when they respond to emergencies.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so do you have that data classified somewhere in law?
No.
That's just your policy. Okay.
Yeah.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is, you know, I think, you know, I'm a landlord, and I think we have someone that regularly comes and inspects our fire extinguishers, and I see this kind of in the same way, I guess. You know, here's a private company, this AFA, and you know, if you don't install the AED, how do you know that it exists if you're a private vendor and you want to service that? Is it somebody, the person that provides the AED kind of has a corner on the market, or how does that work?
Ms. Harkins.
The AED registries really are meant to only help the AED owner. So when they get the notification that their batteries are about to expire or their pads are about to expire, it is really up to them to go back to either their original vendor, whoever they've been working with originally, or, as many do, go on the internet and search out someone who can provide them to the service. None of the registries that are free point you toward any specific vendor. However, we do know that some people will choose to register their AED with their manufacturer or their salesperson, and then, of course, they would get notification from them that they could get their pads and batteries through them.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Scott. So, members, on the list, we have Representative Holberg, Representative Howe, and Representative Neuberger, noting that I know of no opposition who has come forward who's going to oppose this. So, if you can keep your questions as short as possible. Thank you. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on page 2, lines 14 and 15. I'm curious why you haven't required an email address, which would alleviate the need for snail mail. And then I'm also curious why you have the modifier in management. Don't you just want a person? I don't know why you need in management. I think you just need the person. They may or may not have a management title, but they may be in charge of that particular function in their company.
Mr. Bell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the line in 2.14, the registries that I'm familiar with all do when you go to sign up, it is an email because that's an option you can choose, but my understanding was that we were trying to keep it as generic as possible to include all the registries that are out there. And the line in management, I believe, was added when we added, as part of the DE1 amendment, the title. One of the concerns was that we could list a title or a position within an organization as opposed to a person's name. We're always going to have a general manager, but it might not always be John Smith. That was one of the suggestions that we had when we were working with business leaders.
Mr. Holberg? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my final comment on this whole issue. And this is to all the members and everyone that's here in attendance. If you come away from this, if you just remember one thing, AEDs have come a long way from when they first were introduced. If you're ever in a situation where someone goes down, do not be afraid to use one. They have come such a long way. All you have to do is push the on button, and the computer will tell you what to do. It's not going to shock anyone that doesn't need it. So again, I just want to reiterate my point. They're built to be overly simple, and don't be afraid to turn it on because the machine will tell you what to do. They're very, very user-friendly.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Any other questions? Seeing none, then Representative Liebling has moved that House File 1971, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes.
Thank you.
What is on the next page? Okay, and Representative Norton is going to be the next bill up today. Someone want to move Representative Norton's House File 3526. Representative Fortman moves House File 2526 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make a few comments and then walk through the changes in the bill for you, and then we have some fabulous testifiers that I'm anxious to have you hear.
And I would note, before your testifiers speak, Representative Norton, this bill is contentious, and so I'd ask the testifiers, when they come down, please keep yourselves brief. Go ahead, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Dare. I'm bringing this issue before this committee because our current law is not working for the newborns or public health in the state of Minnesota. Besides the impact on families, which you're going to hear about, the law has become a huge barrier to new test development. Newborn screening involves simple tests that are given to babies before they leave the hospital in order to determine whether they are at risk for a variety of disorders that can lead to illness, disability, mental retardation, or even death. It's an essential component of pediatric care that prevents many children from arriving in the emergency room. In most states, newborn screening test results are saved for an extended period to assure proper diagnosis, timely follow-up, and reanalysis. Access to newborn screening data can be critical in emergency situations and helpful in cases of unexplained death. Minnesota currently screens for more than 50 harmful or fatal rare diseases so that early interventions can be given to babies to give them a healthy start. Minnesota Department of Health has a full list of the screening panel, and it's also on the websites if you care to look at it. But the most common disorders tested for are congenital heart disease, hearing loss, sickle cell, cystic fibrosis, PKU. Those are just a few of them. The newborn screening card contains only the information about the mom and baby that will help staff interpret test results and to contact the baby's primary care provider if more testing or follow-up is needed. Storage of the spots provides for follow-up on positive tests and for other program needs as defined in law. Further research requires parental, written, and informed consent. And I want to be clear, I've been really quite surprised with some of the articles and handouts that are stating that we're making radical changes. We're not. We're reverting back to what the state of Minnesota did in a small way from 1965 on. We are trying to clean up the results that have been negative for public health and babies that were a result of an amendment that was passed on the House floor a number of years ago that's caused confusion. Minnesota used to be a leader in this area, but unfortunately the changes of that amendment on the House floor that I told you about have caused unforeseen outcomes. Today we're hoping to make some changes so that Minnesota is no longer an outlier. On the bill itself, I'm just going to go through the changes briefly and then answer questions after the testifiers are in whatever order the chair would like. In the first section of the bill, Section 1, Subdivision 3, we have added the term legal guardian. So we are broadening the scope of who can be responsible for making these decisions. We are also expanding the number of people that will share the information about newborn screening tests and its benefits to include childbirth education programs. So the department now will not just give this information to pediatricians, but also to or OBGYN doctors who primarily care prior to birth, but also to childbirth educators. As we move down, we are moving some language around in the bill, and you'll see line 1.19 is struck because it refers to subdivision 6, which we're removing. And then I think we're making very clear on line 1.22 that the Department of Health may store the blood samples and test results unless the parent or guardian elects not to have them. And this is removing, in the subdivision 6, removing the 71-day limitation and just making it the default position, the storage. At the end, we're clarifying that there continues to be an opt-out position. And again, there's been confusion about this, both in the media and elsewhere, that we are changing the opt-in, opt-out provisions in law. We're not. We're leaving them as they were in 2011 and 12, the changes that were made in law. And we're actually expanding them. And on the next page, on line 2.25 through 2.28, we are adding a third option for parents to be able to opt out. And that's that parents and legal guardians have a right to elect to have newborn screening performed, but then not to have the samples and tests stored past the necessary time. So we're adding one more opt-out opportunity for parents. And then saying that that we're clarifying what the research is and what the newborn screening program is. And again, the newborn screening program is defined in law, and research unrelated to newborn screening always requires a parent to opt in, always. So I think you will see at the bottom of the page in Section 3 and onto the next page the clarification of what the newborn screening program is. It has the only thing that's new on there is in line 3.9, the utilization of blood samples and test results for studies related to newborn screening include studies used to develop new tests. That is part of the newborn screening program. It's what these blood spots are used for, besides confirmatory testing or calibration of the machines. It's also used to develop new tests. Again, it clarifies in Subdivision 7 that additional research not related to newborn screening that might be done always has an affirmative written permission by the parents. And I think on the other section that you might want to see is Section 5. It clarifies if parents do opt to have the test done but their blood spots removed, which is the new, or destroyed, which is the new option we've added, it says that the blood samples must be destroyed within a week of the test, but that the results will be saved based on the CLIA, which is the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments Regulations, which is a federal regulation. So again, Mr. Chair, those are the major changes in the bill. Just to clarify, we're not changing the opt-in, opt-out options. We've added a new one, as a matter of fact, and hope our presenters can give you a little bit more information and answer any questions that the committee might have. Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, and I'm just going to ask this because I am not a doctor and expert, that my when we get to the Q&A part, it might be nice to have those folks down here with me. I can field them myself, but I always feel a little more comfortable to have the experts here. So I can try them myself, but you might want the experts.
Thank you, Representative Norton. We have on the list for testimony Emily Borman-Shope, Carissa Olson, Stacy Nugent, Twyla Braze, and Charles Samuelson. In that order, if you can come down, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony. Please keep your testimony brief.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emily Borman-Shope. I'm a physician and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. I'm also the residency program director, which means I'm responsible for the training of many of the future pediatricians in the state of Minnesota. I'm a general pediatrician, and I'm also the director of normal newborn care at the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital. I'm here to speak today on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which represents nearly 1,000 pediatric providers across the state. I see firsthand in my practice every day the positive impact that newborn screening has on the lives of children in the state of Minnesota. Conditions like sickle cell disease, thyroid problems, cystic fibrosis, and problems with metabolism are diagnosed early, before the baby shows any symptoms. This allows the healthcare team to act early and prevent long-term devastating health consequences, including death. Today, nearly every newborn is screened for these and dozens of other disorders before they leave the hospital, so treatment can begin as soon as possible. As someone who's very familiar with the newborn screening process, I can tell you that the current law passed in 2012 has already undermined the quality of this life-saving program, and this will worsen unless we restore it this session. I am deeply, deeply concerned about the future of newborn screening in our state and our ability to save as many children as possible from needless suffering and death. Newborn screening is a process, not a single event. It involves a few simple tests after babies are 24 hours old to detect heart defects, hearing loss, and more than 50 types of hidden yet treatable disorders. Early detection and treatment are critical. The process is straightforward. Hospitals send newborn screening data, including blood samples, to the Minnesota Department of Health to complete the screening process. Until recently, the Minnesota Department of Health kept newborn screening information for at least 18 years to assure proper diagnosis, timely follow-up, and ongoing program development. Under a new law passed in 2012, the Minnesota Department of Health must destroy this information, robbing families of a tremendous life-saving resource. Most families probably aren't aware of the change until it's too late. Current law mandates that blood spots are destroyed at 71 days when a baby is not even 3 months old, well before a diagnosis can be confirmed in many cases. Additionally, the blood spots of babies who test positive are automatically destroyed by their second birthday, along with all test results, rendering them unavailable for future analysis. Minnesota has become one of a handful of states to destroy newborn screening results, putting babies and families at risk. What's the harm in destroying this data, you might ask? Can't babies simply be retested? The short answer is no, in many cases. Once a newborn blood spot is destroyed, it can never be recovered or replaced. Long-term storage of newborn blood spot screens is critical for accurate and timely diagnosis and treatment. Under the current law, physicians have no way to access or reanalyze a child's newborn screening information after age 2. It has been destroyed. In fact, MDH is not even able to confirm that testing took place. In addition, long-term storage helps to ensure the quality of the testing and for new program development, which is necessary to save more lives. The current law significantly delayed the implementation of a new screening test for a severe immune system problem called SCID, or severe combined immunodeficiency. We missed the opportunity to save the lives of Minnesota newborns. The arbitrary timeframes under the current law are based on the premise of protecting patient privacy. In my view, this fear is misguided and comes at a high cost to children and families. healthcare professionals have the protection of patient data as a core part of our job description, and policies have always been in place at the Minnesota Department of Health to prevent unlawful access to individual data. We should not allow medical care to be compromised for the sake of unfounded suspicions of invasion of privacy. In Minnesota, newborn screening has saved more than 5,000 children from a lifetime of chronic illness, physical disabilities, and death. I urge the 2014 state legislature to remove these arbitrary storage timeframes and expand the window of opportunity for health-related testing for the sake of babies born now and in the future. There shouldn't be an expiration date on critical health information that can save lives.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Borman-Shope. Next testifier, and members, we'll wait on questions until everyone on the list has testified. Carissa Olson. And please be ready after Ms. Olson is completed to testify immediately, Stacey Nugent. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Okay. My name is Carissa Olson, and my husband Darren and I live in Brooklyn Park. Honorable Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. As I said, we live in Brooklyn Park with our two sons, Emerson, age 8, and Everett, who's 5. And I'd like to show you a quick picture of my son. This is Everett, who back in 2009 was on the cover of Minnesota Medicine magazine. And in it, it says, Minnesota's newborn screening program is considered one of the best in the nation. What's important to parents, however, is that it is detecting rare but treatable conditions. Our son Everett was born on April 14, 2008 with a very rare 1 in 70,000 metabolic disorder called galactosemia. It's a potential deadly disorder. He is missing the liver enzyme to properly break down galactose, a milk sugar. The accumulation of galactose is a poison to our son's body and can cause serious complications such as the following: enlarged liver, kidney failure, cataract, brain damage. In fact, as high as 75% of the infants will die if left untreated. Diagnosis is made by newborn screening. Catching this deadly disorder early is key. Even a few days can make a difference. Treatment requires the strict exclusion of lactose and galactose from the diet. I'm a college-educated mom. I tend to be cautious about what we are putting our bodies, and I prefer more natural things about for my family, and I love researching things about health and diet. In fact, my family says I have a PhD from the University of Google. And I didn't think I needed the newborn screening for my son. There were no known genetic disorders in my family. I had perfectly normal, healthy pregnancies, and I already had a healthy older son. The key piece why I at first refused the newborn screen was when I was pregnant, I received a brochure at my church from the members of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I was asked to sign a petition as well. I had read and researched everything else regarding newborn care, feeding, bathing, vaccines, etc., but I filed newborn screening back in my head as something controversial and not necessary. It took effort. 3 hours to be born with no drugs. It was a textbook perfect delivery. A nurse came back into my room and gently but firmly stressed the importance of the newborn screen. She came back 3 times. And I finally realized it wasn't an invasive test, and I agreed to take the newborn screen for my son. I forgot about it, and I left the hospital a day early since I felt great, and I looked like I had a very healthy boy at birth. 4 days later, I went back for a routine visit with our pediatrician. She sat me down and said, that test that you took, remember that newborn screen? It came back positive for galactosemia. I had never heard of it. I was told to stop breastfeeding immediately and put Everett on a dairy-free formula. We were to go back for further testing the following week to confirm the diagnosis of galactosemia. However, a few hours later after getting this diagnosis, he became suddenly lethargic, extremely ill, and his bilirubin was sky high. It was so frightening, and it was a very emotional time. I was told he needed to be admitted to the NIC unit immediately. Catching these metabolic disorders early are key. Timing is everything. With galactosemia, again, there's a 75% infant mortality rate if left untreated. Early detection and treatment is crucial. Everett was in the NIC unit for over 3.5 days and was put on a lifelong restrictive diet with special formula. Today, Everett is a beautiful little five-year-old boy, bubbly, healthy, happy, who loves kindergarten, running, and numbers. And our family is so thankful for the newborn screening program, so thankful. I am troubled and I am heartbroken that the tagline that used to read, Minnesota's newborn screening, is considered one of the best in the nation. It's now one of the worst in the nation. We are one of a handful of states to destroy newborn screening data soon after birth, putting babies and families at risk. I'm on the National Board of Saving Babies Through Screening Foundation because I'm a passionate mom who is not only thankful for this life-saving program, but I stand with the many doctors and researchers here today. For them, the newborn screen has changed their practice, being able to quickly work with a preventive diagnosis within days of being born, rather than watching babies literally die in their arms. I am deeply concerned about the future of newborn screening in our state of Minnesota. Long-term storage of these blood spots and test results are critical for accurate and timely diagnosis and treatment for certain diseases that may not be apparent right away. Newborn screening has saved more than 5,000 children from death, chronic illness, and physical disabilities. We should not allow medical care to be compromised based on fears. My sweet son Everett is one of those saved from a life of brain damage, cataracts, liver and kidney failure, and death. One in 70,000 is a large number. When that one is your child, it's a big number. I urge you and the state 2014 legislature to restore Minnesota's program, save the storage of blood spots to support quality improvement and new test development, and lead. We have been given the opportunity to once again serve as a national leader in saving as many possible lives from death, disability, impairment. Please support HF 2526. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Olson. Stacy Nugent, and the next on deck is Twyla Brace. Please introduce yourself for the record, Ms. Nugent. Begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Stacy Nugent. Just over 4 years ago, I was the proud mommy of a beautiful, smart, and spunky 2-year-old daughter, Paige. Life then was blissful because, like many parents, I wasn't just optimistic about our future, but I felt invincible. I loved being Paige's mommy, and I did everything I could to keep her happy and healthy, which included studying every baby website and even making my organic baby food. Yes, I was that mom. But our future was bright. Then on the morning of March 10th, 2010, at 8 o'clock, I received a horrific phone call from my screaming husband telling me that Paige wasn't breathing. Paige had died in her sleep. This completely unexpected and shocking tragedy was something that I never, ever could have imagined. Even now, it's surreal to share my story. Despite a thorough examination conducted by our very knowledgeable medical examiner in Anoka County, we still do not know why my daughter died. Her death has been classified as sudden unexplained death in childhood, also known as SUDC. SUDC is a sudden and unexpected death of a child over the age of 12 months, which remains unexplained after a very thorough investigation. SUDC is a relatively new diagnosis, and at the time of Paige's death, the SUDC program had only been in existence for 7 years. This means that there is really only about 7 years of focused and structured research to attempt to unravel this mystery, and there's still so much to be learned. Sadly, in the last 4 years, I've witnessed more and more children continue to die. While I would like to know why my precious daughter has died, the answers are especially critical, as I have now been blessed with a subsequent daughter, her 2-year-old sister, Presley. It is very difficult to get through every day when you do not know if you will lose another child. It's as if you wait for the Grim Reaper to come around every corner. This is not a way to live or parent, but this reality is my new life. I have pursued private genetic testing for Presley and have not yet found any reason for concern, but I've been advised repeatedly that the answers could lie in Paige's sample. Last year, a genetic counselor recommended that I test Paige's blood spot card, that had been retained with the Minnesota Department of Health, but also cautioned I should wait just a little bit longer if possible as technology continued to develop. I was advised it would be a real tragedy if we wasted Paige's blood spot, since the sample was so small and that was all that we had left of our daughter. I finally requested Paige's blood spot card last month in order to again pursue testing after being told technology had improved, and I became more anxious. However, when I did, I was devastated to learn that my blood spot cards for both of my children had just been destroyed the day before. It was gut-wrenching to try to comprehend that someone would think it was acceptable to destroy the last remaining piece of my daughter. This action is tragic for me, as I do not have any other way to find out why Paige died, and it makes it increasingly difficult to protect Presley. I wish I could go back to 4 years ago when, like so many other parents, I felt invincible. But we all know that's not possible. I am saddened and disappointed that over 1 million blood spot cards have been destroyed, because we do not have any other idea how many children will lose to SUDC or other known and unknown conditions. I am heartbroken because it's too late for you to help my family. However, I'm here today to represent all of the other parents who do not yet know they need your help. The parents who are currently joyfully expecting babies and do not have any idea that sometime in the future they might live my nightmare. I'm representing the parents who also depend on you, our representatives, to please restore the blood spot program so that we can save the lives of children and protect families.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the next testifier, Twyla Brace.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. So first, I'd like to just remind everybody that newborn screening is the largest single application of genetic testing in medicine, as stated by Dr. Jeffrey Botkin, MD, at the University of Utah's Department of Pediatrics and Medical Ethics. Also, I'd like to draw your attention to the written testimony submitted by the Council for Responsible Genetics. I believe you have it in your packet. Which opposes this bill, saying it is in opposition to recommendations by national committees and research studies. Second, to be clear, this bill is not about the newborn screening program. Babies are being tested today like they were before and after the lawsuit against the department's violation of the genetic privacy law. Instead, this bill is focused on what happens after the newborn screening is over. It's focused on who gets primary control of the DNA of every newborn and who gets secondary control. This bill shifts power from parents to government. House File 2526 gives government first dibs to the genetic code of all newborns. I'd like to draw your attention to several concerning changes proposed in the bill. On line 1.24, the department is required to only disclose information on a form parents may never actually see regarding the benefits of the storage, not the risks. On line 4.6, the requirement to also disclose risks is being deleted. On line 3.28, the requirement to disclose identification and use of the child's DNA for genetic research or test development is being repealed. The switch from consent to dissent is found on lines 2.15, 2.25, and 4.13. On line 3.13, genetic research without consent is being added to the newborn screening program operations. On line 4.24, genetic research is being deleted from the section requiring consent. And finally, the repealer on line 5.13 repeals the 71-day and the 24-month standard retention times, making the storage of the child's genetic information forever, unless their parents discover what happened and sign a dissent form and send it to the department. This bill is a dissent bill. It is the elimination of consent. Consent, as you know, is an affirmative action taken by an individual whereby the government cannot do anything unless they have the signature. No signature, no storage. No signature, no use. No signature, no analysis. No signature, no research. No signature, no sharing. Today in Minnesota, the newborn screening law has a consent requirement for storage, use, and dissemination. This bill only allows dissent. The health department told Minnesota Public Radio that the consent process is too burdensome for them and that only 200 people consented to government storage and use. Perhaps the rest valued their privacy. So now the department wants to take and use what isn't theirs to take and use, the genetic code of the child, and place the burden on parents to stop the government from the infringement. The department knows most people won't opt out because of the burden or because they have no idea it's even happening. And if parents do opt out, if they dissent, the government will also keep a record of anyone who refused the intrusion. Minnesota is one of the only states to truly protect genetic privacy. Oklahoma is another. The law says in Oklahoma, all laboratories, medical facilities, hospitals, and birthing places are prohibited from the unauthorized storage, transferring, use, or databasing of DNA from any newborn child without express parental consent. In a study called Not Without My Permission, Dr. Beth Tarini at the University of Michigan discovered that only 28.2% of parents were very or somewhat willing to have their newborns participate in research if they were not asked for their consent. That means 71.8% would refuse if not asked permission. House File 2526 ignores the 71.8%. It says the state doesn't have to ask for permission. It keeps parents in the dark at a vulnerable time in their life, the delivery of a new child. It eliminates government transparency, moving the state's genetic storage and use research program from sunshine to secrecy. It eliminates parent and individual consent requirements. It creates a large government genetic research program with access to the genetic code of every citizen and non-citizen born from now into the future, unless the parents figure out what's happening and dissent. It violates Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Bill of Rights within the Minnesota Constitution, a right that aligns with the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure without a warrant and probable cause. If passed, you should expect more parents to refuse newborn screening, putting their children at risk. Before the Minnesota Supreme Court ruling in November of 2011, before that ruling gave parents consent rights, our organization was the only one informing parents about the department's secret genetic storage and use program. In 2003, two families refused newborn screening. By 2008, 89 families refused. This bill puts children at risk and repeals the State Genetic Privacy Act without actually repealing the statute. It's a repeal of genetic privacy. It's also a coercive abuse of trust. The government is taking advantage of the parents when they are in a trusted institution, the hospital, and distracted by the birth of a child, and definitely not thinking about the long arm of government reaching into the bassinet to take their child's DNA. We ask you to vote no on House File 2526. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Charles Samuelson. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Charles Samuelson. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota opposes House File 2526. The bill, in our opinion, represents a dangerous effort to enable unlimited retention and to minimize parental consent, allowing newborn blood samples to be used at the whim of government and researchers rather than through the consent of the newborn and their family. To be clear, the ACLU of Minnesota supports screening for identifiable conditions, which could result in substantial harm to the child if not immediately detected and treated. However, outside the narrow use of the samples, informed parental consent is necessary, including the retention of samples after completion of the screen and research and use of samples by states and third parties. The bill is problematic for numerous reasons. It represents a departure from traditional practice. It implicates important privacy and self-determination interests. The information is not anonymous. Finally, obtaining informed consent for the retention and later use after the newborn screening for all purposes is not only possible but practical. House File 2526 represents a departure from the traditional use of newborn blood samples. The program was originally developed for the benefit of the health of the child whose blood is taken. House File 2526 transforms this program into one geared towards benefiting medical research at the expense of individual rights. The bill is also troubling because it takes a blood sample originally used for a clear and finite use and extends this to an indefinite array of possible uses. This bill unnecessarily implicates important privacy and self-determination interests, ignoring them in favor of a policy of unlimited retention and unknown future use of an individual's genetic material for research without informed consent. Some parents, even those who agree with blood sampling in general, do not wish to give up control over the future uses of their sample. Their legitimate reasons include religious beliefs, fear of discrimination because of genetic profiles showing a predisposition to certain diseases, a desire not to know what diseases their children are predisposed to, such as Alzheimer's, the belief that genetic information is their own business, not the government's, and concerns about future potential for law enforcement uses of samples. Even parents who would gladly consent to some types of research object to others. House File 2526 would rob them of the ability to make this determination. The argument that these problems are solved by making the blood sample anonymous is meritless. The samples contain DNA, which makes anonymity impossible. Individual identification is currently possible where a reference sample is available. The ability to identify individuals using DNA is only advancing. These advances, along with the relative ease of disseminating the information, make it more important than ever to obtain consent for use of the samples. The ACLU proposes a simple solution to the difficulties caused by House File 2526. The bill should require informed consent through an opt-in provision for all collection, storage, and dissemination of newborn blood samples other than for screening for identifiable conditions which could result in substantial harm to the child if not immediately detected and treated. Past this narrow exception, the government interest is inadequate, in our opinion, to support non-consensual use of the samples. A parent who consents to secondary uses of infant's blood must know, one, what tissue is being collected and what information can be extracted from that tissue. Two, the period of time over which the sample and any derivative information will be stored. Three, any and all purposes for which the sample and derivative information will be used. And four, to whom and under what circumstances the sample or any data drawn from it may be released to third parties. In addition, the parents must be provided with appropriate privacy notifications sufficiently in advance of the collection in order to deliberate and make a decision. Every parent must be informed of their right to learn later whether and to whom the sample and associated information had been disclosed and how they may later withdraw that consent. Informed consent through an opt-in provision is absolutely necessary to protect the rights of each party involved. It is also unlikely to have a great effect on the interests of the government to obtain a satisfactory broad pool of samples for research. A consent requirement enables parents with those concerns to opt out of certain uses of their children's blood samples while allowing the others to donate their children's blood samples to public health research. Minnesota should pass legislation to aid public health research, however, not at the cost of individual rights over genetic material. An opt-in, informed consent requirement would be simple, uncostly, and would allow the government to reach its research goals without violating the rights of parents and children. Accordingly, we respectively urge this committee to oppose House File 2526.
Thank you. That's all of the testimony of people that have signed up ahead of time. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify regarding this bill? If you could just raise your hand so that I see how many there are. All right, if you come to the table, state your name for the record. Go ahead.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Holberg.
I did want to have the opportunity to question a representative from the department at some point as well.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair and Committee. My name is Alan Bearder. I am one of the nine families who went to the Supreme Court case that was decided last year. I didn't come prepared to speak. I'm going to speak a little bit off the cuff, but I'll keep it brief. Thank you very much for the opportunity. State Supreme Court, as most of us already know, has made a decision in a year ago that requires informed consent. That's the current law. For the collection, limited storage, dissemination, and eventual destruction of the baby DNA that we are talking about today. I understand it's an emotional issue. There's emotions on both sides of how data is handled and where it goes and whether or not you have control over it. Essentially, the Department of Health has already used and collected blood samples for quite a long history. I am totally not opposed to baby DNA research and trying to identify any problems that might occur with a newborn. I think many families benefit from it. I am opposed personally, and along with the other nine families at least, as well as other friends we talked to, about not having informed consent. So much like the ACLU, we want to see informed consent part of this program. This is not the last bill to be produced at any time over baby DNA or genetic research. There will be others. I think there can be improvements. I think, essentially, if we keep the informed consent principle in place, it protects privacy for the individual, and it provides opportunity for others to be able to provide their data, as already spoken, for further research and further storage.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Now we'll open it for questions from members. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Coppola will come to the stand.
Welcome to the committee. Please come to the testifier table. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Coppola. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Coppola. A number of years ago, there was an extensive process in the state to put together a genetic privacy standard. It was a more than a year process involving dozens of interested parties from the medical community, law enforcement, privacy advocates, etc., which resulted in Minnesota's Genetic Privacy Act, which formed the basis for the Supreme Court decision in the Bearder case. Does the department have a position on the Genetic Privacy Act in Minnesota?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, we follow the law, so we don't have an opinion on it. When it's passed, we implement.
Okay, and it's my understanding that the department recently went out for bids on the newborn screening and that the new bids came at a considerable savings to the program. Can you outline for the committee what the previous cost per test was and what the new contract is and approximately how much additional money the department has as a result of that?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, I don't have the exact data in front of me. Previous costs was somewhere in the neighborhood of $23 a test, and the new contract is somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 or $13 per test. So there would be a significant savings over the course of this contract, which has just currently been changed.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, there's been a lot of discussion today about the change in the law that allowed for parents' consent before research. And you were very involved in that bill, as was I. And I'd like for you to share with the committee the discussions about what the health department talked about how they would, under this new standard, how they would inform parents and go about getting consent.
Mr. Coppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, and for the members' benefit, 2 years ago, in 2012, following the Supreme Court decision, we were in a position where the newborn screening program itself was somewhat in limbo due to the decision. We were not only limited to newborn screening being the test of the blood spot and the destruction of that blood spot through a motion we made with the district court, the destruction in 71 days, but we also could not even use that blood spot for calibration of equipment, quality improvement of equipment or verifying test results. So we were in a position where we needed a new newborn screening statute. And Representative Holberg was very involved in helping us balance the decision from the Supreme Court and the needs of the newborn screening program. To be clear, and I think this is a misunderstood piece, genetic privacy statute says that this information, biological, I'm not going to be able to quote it quite right, I'm sure Representative Holberg will correct me, but the data and the blood spot from newborn screening is genetic information. And the statute said if it isn't done through express authority, in other words, if you don't have a law that allows for the collection of this data, then you need consent. And that was the genetic privacy as it impacted newborn screening. We didn't have consent, and we didn't have a statute until 2012 that told us about how we were going to collect and store and involve the consent in that statute. So anything that is passed in statute, and last year we passed it for the rest of the department, a lot of things that interacted with genetic privacy to clarify that we had things in statute so that we wouldn't end up in a legal battle as we did with newborn screening. So I'm giving that as background to say when we negotiated the newborn screening in 2012, we oftentimes, in my testimony, I know I spoke often about drawing a yellow line between the newborn screening program and storage and use. In other words, there's a newborn screening program, which we talk about, that tests every child whose parents don't opt out, vast majority of children every year. That's the newborn screening program, and we use those blood spots for quality improvements. That's program operations, and we destroy them after 71 days unless there is a consent given. We have not operationalized the program. In other words, what was passed in 2012 to go out and get consent from parents to keep blood spots. The form that was put in place has a Tennyson warning. It's on our website. It can be downloaded. There has not been a full-fledged implementation or an attempt to implement that program because we felt that this debate was going to happen last year. We were asked by the legislature to bring back a report outlining different ways that we could proceed on storage and use, and we wanted to wait till this debate and this decision is made, and we will implement whatever decision is made. Certainly some of those resources that Representative Holberg mentioned in terms of the new contract could go help us toward that, but we haven't moved forward with a implementation of the consent requirement that was passed as part of 2012 legislation.
Okay, just a second, Representative Holberg. I'm going to come right back to you as well, but I just want members to know that Representative Lesh had originally scheduled about 35 minutes for this bill. I've already had it going 45, so when he gets back, he's going to be really mad at me. So, Representative Holberg, I will let you go, and Representative Scott has some questions as well. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, didn't you and I and many others have conversations about integrating a program into childbirth classes, OBGYN, pediatricians, that the department would embark on an education campaign to obtain consent under this program?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, we had a lot of conversations about that. It certainly was discussed as something that we would need to do if we were going to make this a successful program. We would need to implement. When we, and I want the committee to understand, the newborn screening program also had a number of things backlogged. We had a new newborn screening test that we were waiting to bring online at this time. There were a lot of other issues that had been complicated by the Supreme Court decision that were waiting to happen. The severe combined immune deficiency program, which had been approved, was waiting to come online, but we couldn't bring it online because we had no way to do quality improvement. All of those things led to a backlog of work. We were never able to come to this next effort, both for financial reasons, because it's costly, and also because there was not interest from the pediatric community, nor others, in a what many felt was a burdensome effort to get consent. So we left it. We took our program. We wanted our program to work. We were desperate for our program to work, and we got it to work. And we added the tests, and we moved forward.
Briefly, Representative Holberg.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And given the recent reduction in the cost of the program, wouldn't it be fairly easy for the department, given that they have the contact information on the card, for them to send a letter upon receipt of the test with a particular time frame for an opt-in within that 71 days of the storage of the blood and get consent?
Mr. Koppel, briefly.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, if there are approximately 70,000 children born in Minnesota, give or take 1,000 or two, if we were going to mail a form and a return envelope or whatever to get consent without explanation, in other words, the current form I think would need to be revised because it's fairly complex, and somebody getting that in the mail may or may not wish to proceed through it. But that's a feasible opportunity. That would be one way to follow up. I don't know of other states that do it. I don't know if it would be successful, but it would be one way to do it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
final question, then I'm going to go to Representative.
I'm not going to ask another question. I'll just make a couple points here. Some people have characterized what happened as going backwards. Others would say that we would be a nation leader in protecting genetic privacy, and that that is a worthy goal to aspire to. So it kind of depends on how you look at this issue. The bill, as I read it, I think will result in more people opting out of the test altogether because there is no ability to protect against use for some types of research within this program. I don't see any prohibition in here for selling samples. I listened to an advocate for this bill talk about the need to buy blood samples from California. I went to the California's website on newborn screening. There doesn't appear to be any consent for California parents on what happens. The definition, all it has to do is be related to newborn screening. That's very loosely defined. The department has the ability to implement an opt-in program. They have contact information. They have chosen not for a variety of reasons. We need to have some continuity of this program from year to year. This is another large swing back the other way. I fear that if this bill is passed, you're going to see this thing swing in another year or two the other way again. I think that this body has to determine whether or not we really want to support our genetic privacy standards in this state. The ability to get consent is not insurmountable. The fact that this bill actually deletes language as far as providing information to the parents at the time of birth or earlier about the program, I mean, I'm not sure that they even have to do the fluffy yellow brochure anymore that they used to do that only had minimal information for parents. And so this goes, in my mind, back farther than we actually were even before the court decision. And I would strongly urge members to oppose this bill in this form.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Next is Representative Scott, then Representative Pugh, then Representative Liebling, then we're going to vote. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to just address the time issue here, and I know you're just the substitute teacher here, but this is an issue that's been worked on for years, and to give it 35 minutes or whatever it ends up being, this is an issue that is very controversial and really needs to be well vetted, and so I'm sorry to hear that it's being rushed through. I have one question for the department, and that is, what is your objection to an opt-in option for parents? What is so wrong with informing them with what that information is going to be used for? What is the problem with an opt-in?
Mr. Capo.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, let me be clear that this is not a health department bill in front of us today, you today. So we don't and have not been involved in the debate. This is the most testimony or interaction I've had.
Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Madam Chair and Mr. Hoppe, that's not a good enough answer for me. I know that the department has a policy on this, and I would like to know why they are so against opting in for parents. Do you think you're not going to get enough people opting in? Is that the problem? Or is there another reason that you would not want to have a parent fully informed of what that information is going to be used for?
Mr. Capo, very, very briefly. Otherwise, this is Representative Norton's bill, and if she has a perspective on why she feels that way, she may want to take this question. Representative Norton, do you want to take the question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the opt-in, opt-out issue has been discussed for many, many years, and I would argue while you're giving 35 or 40 minutes here, this is not an issue that's had little discussion. It's had a lot of discussion. This is about research, and the researchers could answer why this is so important, but it has to do with sample size, you wouldn't want certain populations, certain demographics to opt out of a sample, and it would negate the importance of the research. So you want a robust sample that represents the state or the community that you're talking about. Additionally, this is about saving lives of children, and having these spots allows us not only to save the lives of the 5,000 from the 50 disorders we're already testing, but will allow us in the future to develop new tests through the newborn screening program for future illnesses. And in fact, Carol McFarland stopped in my office the other day, former representative on your side of the aisle, who has a grandchild with a syndrome that potentially could be one of these life-saving, life-changing catches if we can do it early. So it's not just about the kids for today we're catching, but the kids in the future.
Madam Chair, I don't think anyone here in this room is saying that the newborn screening is not a good thing. It's wonderful. It's the genetic testing that goes on after that is problematic, and the storage and the parents not having the ability to have a say. And that's the problem. No one in this room is against the screening of these newborns. There's no one in this room that's against that.
And Madam Chair, I would acknowledge that. That I've heard that stated from people, but we still are mixing. We still require informed consent for research. The only that we're not asking for informed consent for is the newborn screening program, and that they're very different. We've clarified that in law, and we're actually adding another opt-out for parents.
We're gonna let the folks that want to ask the questions. We're gonna give the author the opportunity to, you know, make a closing statement, but we have already spent an hour and 5 minutes on this bill, and so far we're talking a lot about some of the health issues that are dealt with in the health committee as well, so we're trying to stay on the civil law issue. So Representative Scott, did you have one last follow-up before I move to Representative Pugh?
I lost my train of thought, I guess, because I was upset that I get interrupted. But I guess I would like to hear from Ms. Braze as a response to what
we've heard. We've taken all the public testimony we're taking. So, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Mr. Koppel. And my question is, what efforts were made by the Minnesota Department of Health to notify parents that their children's samples were taken, maybe more importantly, that they'd been collected, but let alone that they were about to be destroyed? You know, we just heard that, you know, gut-wrenching testimony by Ms. Nugent, and I'm just really, really disturbed by the lack of communication from the Minnesota Department of Health. You know, there's so many unsuspecting parents out there that have no idea, you know, that samples were collected, and then in this situation, I'm just really concerned about this.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, there are a couple of reasons in that venue. One, this was a long court proceeding that ended at the end of last year, mm-hmm. But was scheduled to go to trial otherwise in January. We were under an order of protection to keep those blood spots in data by the court until the case was over. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know when that was going to happen, number one. Number two, there were 1.2 million spots in question somewhere in that vicinity. Maybe I'm off a little bit there. But so that would approximately been a $600,000 mailing, mm-hmm. to contact those families with a other costs of creating the mm-hmm. information, which we did not have in the program. So we determined that we were also being sued. We were also in litigation, and we were also advised that any activities by the department on this data and blood spots that were being held by the department were really part of that court process, and we were very cautious mm-hmm. about approaching parents or the public about that destruction.
Mm-hmm. Final follow-up question.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for the response, and I just have a statement that I think that the answer here just really underscores the importance of investing in communicating and open and honest communication, especially with parents in this situation going forward. And so, thank you,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, this has been very interesting, and I applaud Representative Norton for bringing this forward, and I think that a lot of the testimony has really misconstrued what the bill is doing, and I think people need to really carefully read the bill, and in particular, I'm really surprised at the ACLU, because Section 7 of the bill requires consent, informed written consent for any research use beyond the newborn screening program itself. Now, what the bill does do is include a little more in the definition of what the newborn screening program is, and that includes the development of new tests. So everybody who benefits from this, who wants their child, their grandchild to be tested, but thinks, oh, but we shouldn't develop any new tests. Well, I guess I would characterize that as kind of a selfish position, because the only way we've gotten to where we are today is that other people's information was allowed to be used to develop the tests that we have. So actually, Representative Zerwa said in the Health Committee, and I think it's very, very important to realize this, if Minnesota is going to be a state where we say, let's not have any innovation, we can do that. But if you want to continue to innovate, you got to take a little step. And I think that this bill attempts to balance the interests. We all agree, just like Representative Scott says, nobody's against newborn testing. Nobody here is against genetic privacy either. We're trying to balance the interests. And in this case, this bill balances the interests pretty well. Now, can it be tweaked a little bit? Sure. And I know that Representative Norton would be open to that. But Representative Hober's comment, how people will opt out if they don't have the ability to protect their information, they do in this bill have lots of ability to protect their information. This bill allows parents to have the testing done and then have their spot destroyed. It allows them, it requires that if they can have the spot destroyed at any time. This gives people lots of protection. But where the balance point is, and I think it was kind of hit pretty well by Representative Pugh here, who's concerned that people don't know their spot is going to be destroyed. You know, the problem is that people don't really know the program. They don't understand the program. They know they've had a spot taken, but they've forgotten that they don't realize they may need it in the future. So how do we strike an appropriate balance? Well, I think this bill does that very well because it says for any other kind of research use, you need written, informed consent to use that spot anytime in the future. But it allows it to be used under the initial opt-out provision for the newborn screening program itself. And if a parent doesn't want that, they have every opportunity to opt out, to have the screening done, have the blood spot destroyed, and let other people's children supply the information to prevent future deaths. So, you know, this is something where we're never going to strike a perfect balance. And I think Representative Norton, she can speak for herself, but would be open to certain tweaks that could strengthen or clarify, you know, what information people get and so on. Because I think, you know, the idea that, you know, people aren't told the downside, you know, okay, we could strengthen that. But this cuts a very good balance, and I really urge people to support it because lives are at stake here.
Representative Norton, if you have a one-minute closing or nothing.
I don't. Representative Liebling hit on the options that parents have. We've increased them in this bill. This is so important, folks, for the children in this state and for research in the state of Minnesota. Please support the bill.
And Representative Scott, it's my understanding that you'd like a roll call. I had everybody on the list. We took everybody's question that was on the list. I said we were going to vote as soon as Representative Leland was done and Representative Norton made her final statement. So the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Lush?
No.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Holbert?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Aye.
Representative Howe?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Leaving?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Aye.
Representative Pugh?
No.
Representative Rosenthal?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
Representative Yaruso?
Yes.
And the motion passes with 9 in favor and 8 opposed. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much.
The next bill on the calendar. Where? Representative Lesh is going to decide what bill we're hearing next.
Representative Mason.
Okay, for those folks who are here whose bill is not going to be heard because we're running out of time, we're going to be reconvening at 6:30 in the Cozy Room 300 North. Representative Mason, Chair moves House File 2274 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. You have a delete all, authors delete all, the DE1. In order to get the bill in this shape, the author desires all in favor of the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes to your bill as amended. Representative Mason, if you could maybe briefly just say what were the changes, if we've got general agreement from that.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, members.
Representative Mason.
In the spirit of cooperation, can I make a couple more verbal changes, and that will take care of some of the opposition. And it would be on line 115. It would in the middle of the sentence without the insert written consent. On line 117. Or protected by the law. And then on 119, and again, I'm doing this in the spirit of cooperation, delete everything after Title 29.
So, I'm sorry, Representative Mason, this was
what the amendment did, or you want to further
I wasn't able to catch it. This during the interim, we've made some changes that the people that were going to oppose it, in spirit of cooperation, we're inserting this.
Okay, so that was in the DE amendment. So you're saying we passed the DE amendment too soon, Representative Mason?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Chair moves reconsideration of the DE-1 amendment. All in favor, signify. Well, okay. Representative Scott.
Can staff reiterate that? Because I missed some of the wording of the oral amendment.
Yeah, we'll reconsider first. All in favor of reconsideration, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Mr. Gehring.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I understand the proposed oral amendment to the DE-1 amendment is includes the following changes. On page 1, line 15, before consent, insert written. So it would say permit an employee without the written consent of the employer. On page 1, line 17, after privilege, insert or protected by law. So that the phrase would read, or information that is otherwise subject to a legal privilege or protected by law. And on line 1.19, delete everything after Title 29. So you're deleting or any other provision of state or federal law protecting employee disclosure or discussion of wages.
Representative Scott?
I'm good.
Okay. Any other questions about those changes to the DE-1 amendment? All in favor of the amendment to the DE-1 amendment as stated by Mr. Gehring, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. We're back on the motion for the DE-1 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So, your file, Representative Mason, which is 2274 as amended. Go ahead, Representative Mason.
Thank you very much. What we've done in the DE-1 is to add more details, and specifically, I think the one portion that was really important to your committee was the questions about discussion about who could discuss this, and this does zero in between employees being able to discuss it, and that to me is a major help. And what I will do is turn it over to Lisa Stratton to give you the details.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Stratton. I'm the Executive Director of Gender Justice, a nonprofit law firm and advocacy organization. We have been working hard on this bill since the last time we were here. A lot of the questions relating to how it would apply to employees, particularly possibly disclosing outside of a company, have been dealt with to the satisfaction of the folks representing the employers, and we feel like we have a much narrower but still good, worthwhile, and important bill. It has narrowed down the point on discussion, when employees can discuss wages with other employees. The key paragraph there under subdivision 8, it's subdivision 8A3. The only thing that is prohibited, the only thing employers can't take adverse action about is an employee disclosing their own wages or discussing another employee's wages that were voluntarily disclosed to them. So there should be this should eliminate any concerns about data being shared, lists of employees being shared. It's one employee can discuss with another anything that was voluntarily shared. I mean, that's true today, and the purpose, except for in these circumstances where employers either implicitly or explicitly tell employees they can't talk about it at all. So what this does is make that not possible. They can't have them employers can't require the non-disclosure and non-discussion of any person's wages, even your own, as a condition of hiring. And they can't have an employee sign a waiver or contract that says it is denying their right to discuss their wages. And then the third piece is that You know, all of those are really sort of useless unless you can at least talk to your coworker, and if they voluntarily share their wages with you, that is information that you are allowed to discuss.
Thank you, Ms. Stratton. Knowing that we are over committee time, questions from members. Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I still don't think you got it quite right. If you look at lines 10 through 12, I think you need more language that the voluntary disclosure is about their own personal wage. I could voluntarily disclose my good friend Representative Anderson's wage to you, and then there wouldn't be any recourse.
Ms. Stratton?
I think once you're still talking about one employee talking to another at a time, and any of these, not that this is intending to take away any rights under the National Labor Relations Act. We talked about that last time. That could provide some protection to some class of employees, and as the last section says, not intending to diminish any of those rights. But one-by-one conversations among employees is what the bill is designed to protect. And the as far as we understand, the representatives of the business community are not opposed to this.
But, Mr. Chair, I don't believe that what you are trying to get at is for me to disclose other people's wages. I think you're trying to get at that I can disclose and have conversations about mine. So because you don't specify that the voluntary disclosure is only about that person's individual wage, and again, my example, if I go start talking about other people's wages voluntarily, that should not be allowed.
Representative Liebling, was your comment to this point?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think that Representative Holbrook's concern might be taken care of if we just insert the word own on 1.11 after employees, if it says for disclosing the employee's own wages.
Representative Holbrook?
I think that's the intention, and that would clarify the language just a bit.
Representative Holbrook?
Mr. Chair, I think it makes it better.
Okay. Any other comments on that? Representative Liebling? Was there any commentary on that before you offered the amendment? Okay. Ms. Stratton?
Unless an employee, the purpose of this statute, I didn't want to repeat myself, but the purpose is to help enforce the pay equity laws. To allow someone, if you can't compare yourself to anyone else, that is not helpful. That's the point, is to be able to at least compare to your peer or coworker.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so Representative Liebling.
So I would move an oral amendment on line 1.11 to insert the word own, O-W-N, after the word employees.
But
and the first employee, so it would be the employee's own wages.
Well, I think Representative Liebling, Ms. Tran's point is that if you can't compare it, then it defeats the purpose of the law. The change, and that by your amendment you wouldn't be able to compare it. Am I missing that point?
Mr. Chair, I think you're missing. I think no, I'm not changing the meaning of the sentence. I'm just clarifying the meaning.
Okay.
So no, this is protecting an employee for who discloses their own wages and or discusses another employee's wages which has been disclosed to that person voluntarily. I think that's what we're trying to do here. So it just clarifies that meaning, I think.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, when you first said it, I thought you meant after the second employees, and I thought that actually addressed what the question was. Maybe we need it. I don't think we need it in both places because the first employees is the subject of the sentence.
Right.
Mr. Chair, that's the amendment was after the first.
My question was whether it shouldn't be after the second.
No.
Representative Liebling, can you clarify your amendment, the amendment you're making now?
Okay, Mr. Chair, on line 1.11, the amendment would simply insert after the first instance of the term employees to insert the word own. So the sentence would read, take any adverse employment action against an employee for disclosing the employee's own wages or discussing another employee's wages which have been disclosed voluntarily.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understood, the issue that was raised right before this The question was whether the back half of that sentence, the discussing another employee's wages, would allow a third party to discuss another employee's wages. And so that if we were to put the word own there, that would clarify that this was only two parties involved here, that it was an employee and another employee. So it's difficult to describe it without, as Representative Holberg did, using names. So as it's written right now, the concern is that if I wanted to have a discussion with you about Representative Rosenthal's wages, the current language doesn't prevent that. And inserting the own after me on the front end of the sentence doesn't take care of whether or not you and I can discuss Representative Rosenthal's. And so I don't think only putting it at the beginning of that sentence actually addresses that concern. I don't think it does any harm to put it in the first spot, but I don't think it addresses what that issue was.
Members, it's not even 10 o'clock yet, and I think everyone's brains are still fuzzy. So it's probably the intention of the chair to lay this over until we come back tonight at 6:30 in room 300 North. And perhaps by that point we can get everyone on the same page with what specifically we want to do with this. Until then, the committee's in recess. Committee is back in, and the most punctual East Sider, Tim Mahoney's bill is up, 2722. Representative Mahoney, you, and there is a cast of characters at the table, probably also in the audience, who has worked very hard on this for years. Am I right?
Yes, well, Mr. Chair.
Then, Representative Mahoney, the motion, the chair moves House File 2722 be referred to Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. You have no amendments, am I correct?
There's no amendments to this bill, Mr. Chair.
Then to your bill, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, as you indicated, we have been working long and hard on this, and I want to thank a lot of people. I'm going to be very quick about it. I'm going to thank Minnesota Legal Aid, Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, University of Minnesota and their Department of Social Sciences, the Minnesota Father Project, the Hennepin, the judges from the judiciary, Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women again, the Center for Parental Responsibility, the AAML, the AFCC, Minnesota Bar Association, the Minnesota Association for Justice, and the Family Innocence Project. There's a whole cast of characters that have been involved in this. We've spent the last year plus a few months. We've been in mediation. The governor vetoed a 35% bill 2 years ago, asked people to get together and talk. I really had no interest nor any belief that it would actually do anything. One of my opening statements was that I didn't trust anybody in the room when I walked into the room of all these people. Today, I can say I actually trust the people to talk openly, honestly, and keep their word. And I want to thank all of them. That's quite the statement after 10 years of battering around with the child custody stuff. I was pretty bruised. I think a lot of people were very bruised. So I'll get right to the bill. These have all been vetted through all the groups that I mentioned earlier. On page 1, line 7, there is no presumption for or against joint physical custody except when domestic abuse, as is in section 518B, has occurred between the parents. We're just putting that into law because they're to make it clearer for judges. At 1.20, the court shall not use one of these factors to be considered to the exclusion of all other factors. That goes to 1.10 through 1.19. Just says that you can't, just because you can't agree on a custody issue, it's not something you can be used against you, or claimed an inability to cooperate, or at this particular time you can't resolve the dispute. You have to use them all. On page 2, right at the top of the page, disagreement alone over whether to grant joint sole or joint custody does not constitute an inability of parents to cooperate in rearing their children. This clarifies it and gives the judges a little direction when people are getting a divorce. They're not always at their best, and we're just saying that that's just not going to. If you're in an argument over who gets more time, that's not part of the problem. It's you have to set that aside. Sections 2.4 through 2.8. We're just asking the courts to explain their reasoning for doing this, for making their decision one way or the other, so that people can understand it. One of the things that we all agreed on in this group was that people did not understand how the courts were working and coming to their decision, so they're looking to get more of that understanding. Starting in 2.14, the court, when issuing a parenting time order, may reserve a determination as to a future establishment or expansion of a parent's rights. In that event, the best interest standard set forth in subdivision 5 and paragraph A shall be applied to a subsequent motion. This is telling the judges, because many of them know, but it is not in law, so they don't know that they can do it, that they can say, this is a temporary fix right now. This is 6 months, this is a year and a half, this is 2 years. And you're going to come back, and we're going to review this. And the last of this, 3.15 to 16, consideration of a child's best interest includes a child's changing development needs. Many of us have teenagers. We know that they are different than five-year-olds. Well, wait a minute, sometimes they aren't, but they are different. And they need to take into consideration the development needs of the child, setting up the parenting time. And on 3.23, a modification of parenting time, which increases a parent's percentage of parenting time to an amount between 45.1 to 54.9 percentage parenting time, is not a restriction of another parent's parenting time. And that is in response to a Supreme Court decision that we all pretty much agreed didn't make much sense. They said that it was. If they changed the parenting order, it was a restriction of the other parent's time. And that's really not what it is. You're just trying to get the best for the kid. That's what this bill does. These are small steps. Hopefully we'll continue to talk and find places where we can agree and we can find things that work for kids. That's really what the whole goal is. Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions, but I do want to, there's many people that were involved in this in the audience here on both, all over. I could name them all, but I won't, because I know you have other things to do tonight.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. At the beginning, your introduction is something like an Academy Award speech, which, of course, I mean, is fitting, considering the number of folks that have helped out and deserve credit for this. But, members, as my dear departed grandpappy told me, don't screw up a good thing by talking it to death. So with that in mind, if you want to testify on this, come down and do testify. But, I think you can read between the lines. Representative Holberg. And if you do want to testify, come down now. Go ahead, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your work on this. I know it's an emotional issue and it's not an easy one to deal with, but I'm just curious why in the structure of the bill the issue about the changing development needs of the child, why that was not put in the best interest statute, in that section where everything, you're saying it should be considered as part of the best interest. Why didn't you put that language in that section of law?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg. It's probably, once you open up best interests of the child, you're opening up a lot of different places and things, and people were very hesitant to go there. So rather than go there, they were more comfortable putting it in this other place. Once you open that up, they were very fearful that those we would be changing words and not only just one thing but others, and we didn't want to open up that can of worms. Not at this particular stage, anyhow. I mean, people had to build the trust on them, of the group.
Representative Holbert?
Well, Mr. Chair, we have the horror stories where little remnants are put in weird places of law, and I think if everybody's in agreement, it would make more sense if it's a new best interest standard that it be placed in that section of law and not in the parenting time section. Just a comment.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if Michael Ditburner here is here, and he helped draft the language, and he may have some insight to that, answer that question.
Mr. Ditburner, please introduce yourself for the record and give an answer.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Ditburner. I'm with the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, Minnesota chapter. There is, in the best interest statute, I do believe, consideration of the needs of the child, including the child's development. What we were trying to deal with here was a modification of parenting time statute in subdivision 5 of FAVE 18.175. And so that's why there's the word changing developmental needs. The idea that those developmental needs do change over time, and the court should consider those changes over time when considering a modification of parenting time, a change of parenting time. That's why the phraseology is used.
Thank you, Mr. Ditburner. Representative Scott.
Okay.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Is there anyone from the public who wants to come down and be heard on House File 2722?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I'd just like to say that As Representative Mahoney indicated, this has been quite a long process, and we're still in process, and this is just the first of what we hope will be more modifications to this section of law as we work together and find more common ground. So we're hopefully this is just a start.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Seeing no other comments, questions, or testifiers, then the chair has moved that House File 2722 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative
Chair.
Committee. Representative Moran. House File 2373. Is she outside or what's the story?
She's up in
Sandy's
here.
Okay, well, looks like we'll do Sandy's. Representative Mason, House File 2274. Where's my
Mr. Chair, members?
1 minute, Representative Mason.
Do you want to...
Representative Mason?
What?
1 minute.
Okay.
Okay, chair takes the bill from the table, 2274, that had been laid over. We adopted the DE 1 minute. We adopted the DE 1 minute. Yeah. So to the bill as amended, picking up where we left off, Representative Mason, what has been accomplished since this morning?
Okay, first of all, I think maybe we need to clarify. Representative Liebling had suggested putting own in line 1.11. Did you accept? Was that accepted? Is that part of it right now?
Not yet, Representative Mason.
Okay. I'm comfortable with that, and then there's one more line that we're going to put in, and then that's it. On 1.20, permit the employee to disclose wage information to a competitor or of their employer. That is the bill.
Okay, Representative Mazin, if you could, maybe I could have, Mr. Gehring, are you familiar enough with it where you could stay? Okay, Representative Mazin, state clearly the two separate amendments, just so that we're clear
okay.
on the record what we're talking
when
about.
When we were here this afternoon, Representative Liebling, sorry about that, on 1.11, she had suggested putting employees' own wages on 1.11.
Where in 1.11, Representative?
Right after employees. It would be the second word in.
After the first employees, insert the word own. Okay.
Right.
Next.
And then we had already talked about on line 1.15 putting without the written consent. That was in this afternoon. And then on line 117, or protected by the law. And then on 1.20, permit the employee to discuss wage information to a competitor of their employer. And that is the bill.
Okay, so can I do that all as one amendment? Okay, so to all of that, as an amendment, as stated, to modify. Wait, do I need to reconsider the DE1 amendment then? Okay. Amending House File 2274 as already amended for the amendment as stated, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay. So the amendment has been amended. Representative Mazin, go ahead.
I would, with those amendments, there should be no opposition, and I would ask for your, I would hope you would approve the bill.
Okay. Questions for members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we could have someone from the chamber or the business community just testify that they're okay with this new language.
Okay. If we can. Go ahead, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to thank Representative Mazin and the advocates for working on this with us. I think this is a reasonable conclusion and that they address our concerns, and I appreciate that, and I think that this language accomplishes eliminating those concerns from the business community.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Then seeing none. Chair renews the motion that House File 2274, as amended, be referred to Committee on Jobs and Economic Development Policy. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Chair members, thank you very much for your patience and your time.
You, have we found Representative Moran yet? There she is. Excellent. I have a motion for Representative Moran's House File 2373 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. Representative Hillstrom moves. Representative Moran, you have two author's amendments. I understand they're labeled A4 and A5. Can you confirm that, in fact, those are the amendments you're looking to add?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chair.
Okay. In order to... you want both those, is that right,
Representative? Yes.
Okay. In order to get the bill in the shape the author so desires, all in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Again, in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, your bill has been amended. Representative Moran, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The purpose of House File 2373 is to begin correcting the gender earning gap in the Minnesota workforce to improve the economic status of women. Minnesota women who are working full-time and year-round still earn only 80% of the earnings of their male counterparts. And a gap is even larger for women of color, rural women, and older women. Furthermore, the gap is not going away on its own. It has been stagnant for the last 10 years. Minnesota has had pay equity laws on the books for 30 years now. And gender pay equity is now a reality for all state employees for every city, county, and school district in the state. Now it's time to build on that success by extending pay equity to private businesses that want to contract with the state. This bill builds on both the success with pay equity laws and the state long practice of requiring these same businesses to submit affirmative action plans in order to bid on state contracts. So we think this bill offers a first step in the process of ensuring that companies doing businesses with the state are paying women equally for the work of equal value. The bills offer a phase-in process and keep business data practice private. It applies only to contracts for goods and service over $500,000 in businesses with more than 40 employees in Minnesota. The basic requirement, which takes effect after the first year, is this. A business with more than 40 employees in Minnesota seeking a contract of more than $500,000 must have a pay equity plan certified by the Commissioner of Human Rights. Much of the same way the commissioner now approves the company's affirmative action plan. To obtain a certificate, the company must submit basic information about its pay equity plan to Human Rights. And so I will stop there, and my hope is that I can garner the support of you guys and can be really diligent to Representative Holbert to answer some of those data practice questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Questions from members? Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make another statement. I've looked at this, and I don't know if I spoke to you directly or somebody else. I've looked at so much stuff in the last 2 weeks, but it would be a much better bill if you outlined the data sets that the commissioner had access to. You are leaving all the discretion to the commissioner as to what they can ask, and that's really not
Representative Moran.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert. That is part of the amendment that we just introduced, the A4 amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Do you want to take a look at that, Representative Holbert? We can come back to
Mr. Chair. I think I'm sorry that I'm tired. I missed this, but yeah, this looks a lot better than what this was doing. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Any other members of the public who would like to come down and be heard on House File 2373 as amended? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any timeline as far as when they submit, when they get this back? I'm thinking of if I've got a company and I want to compete on a contract, I submit this information. What's the reasonable timeline when I'm going to get this back?
Ms. What? Or Representative Moran?
Mr. Chair, I would like to defer that question to the commissioner, if possible.
Say again, Representative Moran?
I would like to refer that question to the commissioner of Human Rights.
Okay,
Kevin
great.
Lindsay.
Commissioner Lindsay, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kevin Lindsay, and I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Representative Howe, members of this committee, and Mr. Chair, typically the Department of Human Rights at the present time averages 13.1 for the last 6 months on applications for workforce participation. About 80% of those initial applications are processed in less than 3 days. So that 13 average, we really have a couple of outliers that we go back and forth with, which really kind of drives up that number. But for the most part, about 80% are done in 3 days. Now, this is new work which would be done by the department, but that would really be the goal in which we'd be striving for, something very efficient and expeditious so we can, would not be a burden to holding up the contracting process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question, what do you, going down that line, how many applications do you anticipate getting with this? How big of an increase of workload are you looking at with this new requirement?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Howell, Chair Lesh, and members of the committee, we have been in conversation with officials from the Department of Administration, and right now we estimate somewhere between an additional 1,000 to 1,200 certificates we would issue gender pay equity certificates.
Any other questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies again to the committee. I did read the language. There's no modifying language in here. Limiting it to these data sets. This language just says it must include, but there's no parameters on limits of what the commissioner can ask for. And so it does not address the issue.
So,
through Representative Holberg and Chair Lesh and members of the committee, if you take a look at the administrative rules which govern the work of the Department of Human Rights, in those administrative rules you would find that the commissioner is limited in the same way that a private party within litigation is limited. So I would have to show that there is a reasonable relationship to the purpose of why I was asking for the information, or sometimes, which is used within civil litigation, that it's reasonably calculated to lead to information which would be reasonable for me to have. So I could not go on a wild fishing expedition on any and all information of the contractor. It would have to be for the purposes of determining good faith efforts from pay equity.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's all great and good that it's in rules, but we as policymakers should establishing a new program should establish the program in law, what the parameters of the request. So I'd like the opportunity to work with the Commissioner and Representative Moran, find out exactly what data sets you want to get your hands on, spell those out in law, and then we won't have to have litigation over whether it was reasonable or whatever. We will have spelled out the parameters of the program.
Just so I'm clear, Representative Holberg, are you looking for definite parameters with respect to known data sets now, or are you okay with indefinite, definition of what data sets would be permissible, only spelled out in statute, similar to what Commissioner Lindsay just said is spelled out in rules? Was that an unfair question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd rather have data sets spelled out in law, and I think it's doable if they are doing this for public sector entities already, that there's some model for this. But, for example, are you going to collect individual names of employees? Is that your intent?
Mr. Lindsay?
Representative Holberg, Chair Lesh, and members of the committee, no, it would not be to publish individual names.
Mr. Chair, my question was not publishing. My question was collecting.
Representative Holberg, Chair Lesh, currently within the administrative rules now, if the employer believed that was proprietary information, we would come up with a scheme. For example, we might assign a code for respective employees, so we would refer to as employee 0001 and then continue down to, you know, to 100 employees for in that instance. So that already exists as a matter of law.
Mr. Moran, this is going to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. Between here and there, would you work with Representative Holberg to ensure that it gets addressed the way that she wants? Because the Chair's in agreement that it should be spelled out that way.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Does that satisfy concerns? Representative Holberg, I know that you want to get data stuff done in a data committee, but as long as you're okay with that, Representative Holberg, I appreciate the nonverbal cue. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm sitting here looking at a picture of my grandson kissing Cinderella, trying to stay in my happy place.
You don't want to know what my happy place looks like.
That might be a fair warning.
Right. Okay, are there any other questions? Representative Howell.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at, and maybe this is technical in nature, but I'm looking at the A4 amendment, and I'm looking at lines 1.2 and 1.3 where it talks about page 1, line 14. I don't see the word no more in here, and I'm just struggling to find where that exist. Am I looking at the wrong bill, or?
Okay, so apparently, Mr. Garrick, do you want to answer that question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, it looks like the A4 amendment was drafted to the first engrossment of the bill, but the version that you have in the committee packet is actually the introduced version.
Okay, I was unclear on that, Mr. Garrick. Did we amend the correct version of the bill that the committee has in front of us, or did we not?
Mr. Chair, so the committee has in its packet the introduced version, which is not the version that's technically in front of the committee right now.
This is the first engrossment. She has a copy of the
motion. Okay.
With the no more in it.
Okay, so the proposed amendment, all I want to know is did the A4 and the A5 amend the correct version we have in front of us? That answer is no.
Not physically,
That the committee has. Procedurally, did we do the correct thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Did.
Okay, so Representative Howe, was that your question? I'm spacing now. I can't remember.
Well,
go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what we have in our packets is not what does not match this. I guess there's a first engrossment that we haven't seen. That'd be the issue.
Well, it's okay. So Representative Howe, it's online and everything's posted the way it needs to be. Clerically, what got put in your packet was not okay.
Got it.
Ms. Leffels is taking blame for that one. It's my fault.
It's under stress. Yeah, I can go make copies. No.
Okay. is there anything else? I need your picture, Representative Holbert. So the motion was I believe. Representative Hillstrom's motion that House File 2373 as amended be referred to Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So, next bill. Is Representative Mullery here? I saw him earlier. He is there. Okay. Representative Mullery, Chair moves to re-refer House File 2151.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, would you move the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape the author would
request? I would, but we need a motion first for Representative Mullery and where this is going. One moment. Okay. The motion is it moves to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy, Representative Mullery, and you have a delete all amendment, Representative Mullery?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And that is labeled the DE1 amendment. So in order to get the bill in the shape Representative Mullery desires, all in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, having practiced contract law for about 35 years, there's always a duty to mitigate. And however, in leasing law, that isn't built into the law like it is in all other areas of law, basically. And so what this would be doing is creating a duty to mitigate on both sides of the issue. And one of the problems that's occurring is for people that are they're moving out for some reason, the landlords are going to them and saying, look, I can sue you for the rest of it, or you can pay me a big fee and then we'll let you out of it. And so that's obviously not something that we should be promoting. And so this would require that both sides have a duty to mitigate, and it does specifically, the amendment makes sure that, because at the last meeting the landlords raised the issue of whether they'd have to then prefer that property in releasing. And so this specifically in this amendment says that they don't have to use any preferential treatment to show or lease the unit in question after it's vacant. And so with that, Paul Bernberger would be testifying.
Mr. Bernberger, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Lesh and the committee members. My name is Paul Bernberg. I'm the senior housing attorney at Homeline. We're a nonprofit tenant advocacy agency. A large fraction of what we do is to run a tenant hotline, advise tenants about their rights and responsibilities. Just to make clear on what the duty to mitigate is, I'm going to give an example. Suppose I agree to sell Representative Lesh 100 gallons of milk for $300 wholesale for him to pick them up. He runs short on money and says he won't come and he won't pay. Am I allowed to just sue him, or do I have to at least try to sell the milk? In all examples except landlord-tenant law, except the situation of non-payment of rent, the answer is I have to at least try. I don't have to succeed, but I have to at least try, like put a sign up, put a note on the bulletin board for wholesale milk, etc. If another person like Representative Hillstrom is more honorable or has more money, comes to me and says, I'll pay the $300. I have to take it if she's a suitable purchaser of milk. And that's what mitigation is, an effort to try. And literally, it's a colonial rule of law that says that a landlord does not have to mitigate. I mean, it's left over from colonial law. Bit by bit, the law has changed. I passed out a map, I believe, through the page showing the states that are left. We're now down to 6 states in the United States that don't have a duty to mitigate. We're the last 6 out of 50 plus the District of Columbia. That's 40 and one state, South Dakota, where the rules are unclear. The reason this matters is Representative Mullery said, sometimes a tenant will break a lease because of divorce, lost job, a better job somewhere, an illness, or needs a specialist hospital, some other county, or some other personal reason. It is true most landlords, but not all, will try to mitigate just because it makes good business sense. But there are following problems. One, some landlords won't try. Some landlords essentially won't try. They'll do nothing, and then when they get presented with a good replacement tenant, they reject them. The more common thing, and I see one or two of these a week in my practice, just me, and I'm just one of 5 attorneys at Homeline, the landlord will make a deal with the tenants to say, if you pay X dollars, like usually a few $100, sometimes a month of rent, or even 2 months sometimes, I will try. Not I will succeed, but I will try. Essentially, it's a ploy to get money to do what the landlord's going to do anyhow. And then occasionally you get a situation where the tenant brings a quality replacement tenant to the landlord and says, here, I've got a quality replacement tenant. Please take them. In fact, I think I passed out what one of our recent tenants would have testified to if she could come this evening. And the landlord says, okay, but pay me $450 and I'll take the quality tenant you just brought me, which is going to cost the landlord maybe $30, $40 to review that tenant. So you get these sort of, because we're this odd state that doesn't require mitigation, the landlords can get away with this. Not most of them don't, but there's always the 10 or 20% that do. The last thing I want to comment on is the key to this bill is the very beginning that says the landlord has the duty to mitigate. Everything else essentially is details. I know we've had some discussion from the landlord's trade group in front of Representative Clark's committee on this issue, and actually we've had some conversations with them where they presented us with a proposed alternative that concentrates more on the landlord duty to mitigate and less on the exact subleasing assignment. And actually I think that before we get in front of a Senate committee, I think we're going to be able to work out some sort of language that everybody can live with. I'm hopeful for that, and I'd urge you to pass this bill. And I believe there's one more testifier.
Thank you for testimony, Mr. Bernberg. Is there, are there any other testifiers who wish to be heard on House File 2151? Please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony.
My name is Lawrence McDonough. I live in St. Paul. I'm an attorney at Dorsey & Whitney. I've been an attorney practicing landlord-tenant law for about 30 years. Spent about 25 years as the main housing attorney at Legal Aid in Minneapolis. And I've worked on a lot of legislation and landlord-tenant law over the years. I've taught at all the four law schools. And one of the things I'll say is I commend you guys on having one of my former students, Emily, working on the committee here. And she can correct any misstatements I make about landlord-tenant law because she did really well in my landlord-tenant law class. But I'm also a landlord. I'm a landlord in Bloomington, and I'm a former landlord in St. Paul, so I feel like I can see this from various sides. I've put together a handout that's fairly short that's being passed out. And I'll just summarize that briefly. There are quite a few areas of case law where mitigation is required, and landlord-tenant law is best I can tell, the only one where it's not required. Other types of contracts, employment contracts, in the personal injury area, quite a few areas it's required. Only not required by the case law on landlord-tenant. The burden of proof is always on the person who has breached the contract, saying that the other side hasn't been reasonable in trying to limit their losses. The cases are very fact-specific, and when you look at other statutes that have discussed mitigation of damages, and I've got some quotes in my outline, you can see that they really focus on the general principle and don't get mired in the details. And so I would just encourage passage of this. I can say as a landlord myself, I've never had any problem with the concept of mitigation of damages. It doesn't require the landlord to eliminate their damage. It just requires a reasonable effort, and that's the requirement that the case law has put in pretty much all other areas with the exception of landlord-tenant. Last thing I add that's not in my outline is I'm a member of an observer group of a national commission that's looking at revising model laws on landlord-tenant. It's got kind of a hoity-toity name. It's the original one is the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act of 1972, and there's a revision process going on right now. And both of those acts have a very simple mitigation of damages provision. It's in the original act from 1972. There hasn't been any proposal to take it out of the revision, and all it says is pretty short and sweet, just says that both landlords and tenants have a duty to mitigate damages. So I think by passing this, we'll be in line with almost all of the United States as well as the uniform law drafters. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. McDonough. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 2151? Please.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. For Mr. McDonough.
Wortman.
Sorry, I don't want to make everybody wait. It's a question about the burden of proof.
Yes.
Is the duty to mitigate here a defense that the defendant can raise, or is it the affirmative duty of the plaintiff to establish?
Mr. McDonough.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Wortman. Rather than say plaintiff and defendant, since they can be mixed in different cases, I'll just say, so Party A breaches the lease, and Party B is then saying, okay, I'm damaged because of this. Now, Party B has some obligation to minimize their losses, and that's what mitigation of damage is. And so if Party B sues the breacher, Party A, and says, you owe me X, Party A can say, well, I don't think you mitigated damages. Party A has to prove that. So the obligation is on Party B to mitigate damages. The burden is on Party A to say, I don't think you did a good enough job at it. And the standard is a reasonableness standard. So when you're actually in court, the party that mitigated doesn't have to prove they mitigated. The party that's essentially defending the claim that they owe some money has the burden of saying, the other party should have mitigated and didn't do it the right way. So sorry if that's kind of a complicated answer, but that's how
Can
these things kind of fly.
Follow
if
up, then?
Test, Representative Horvath.
Then is that the same construct that is used in other cases where there's a duty to mitigate? Or are we, or is it different in the way that we're setting it up for landlord-tenant relationships?
Mr. Chair and Representative Horvath, the bill would basically set it up the same way. The case law is just unified by various subject areas that that's how the burden worked. There's nothing here to shift that in any other direction. And that's really the consistent paradigm around the country.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you know what? You've had enough. And I granted the latitude for Representative Horvath. We're going to bring in another, the other testifier, Mr. Liljenquist. And if we could hold questions till the end. Mr. Liljenquist, please identify yourself for the record. Begin your testimony. Please keep it brief.
Thank you. Will do, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Todd Liljenquist. I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. And we respectfully oppose this bill, House File 2151. It is true, contract law in Minnesota does require mitigation of damages, but one important point is that real property law is not just made up of the contract. Real property law, according to common law, also includes a possessory interest, an interest in that real property, and that's why at common law there was no duty to mitigate. So that is an important point, and that is why there has been no duty to mitigate in the past. We do oppose the bill for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it operates under the presumption that landlords do not mitigate damages as it is. It is according to their business and economic and public safety interests to mitigate damages. A landlord who sits back and does not make best efforts to re-rent is a landlord who will not be in business very long and will not own that property very long because it is in their best interest to re-rent that property as quickly as possible. But more importantly, we believe that this bill requiring a duty to mitigate will undermine the value of the lease. If a duty to mitigate is required, the easiest way to get out of the lease is to simply no longer pay. And then the obligation becomes the landlord's to re-rent that property. One of the big areas of concern in the bill, too, is the assignment and sublease portion, and I won't get into that too much. We have another testifier who can speak to that a little more thoroughly. But there are a number of questions and concerns and examples that are not addressed in the Delete All Amendment before you. Number one, what does reasonable efforts mean? Number two, there are a number of contract provisions that are not codified in the proposal before you that a landlord and a tenant do negotiate when they enter into the contract. For example, a break lease clause or fee. And what that says is there is a clause in the lease that says if you want to break the lease during the term of the lease, you can pay 1 month or 2 months rent, whatever that is. The parties have agreed to that. The parties have negotiated that in there. And securing of that clause or that right is not clearly delineated in the language here. Payback of unearned concessions, that is not included in here, which in that case it would be you can enter into a year lease and get the first month's free, first month rent free, and 6 months into the lease, if you vacate and abandon the property, there are clauses in leases that require payback of those of that that first month's rent. Liquidity damages is also not included. And we've had discussions with, as Mr. Bernberg pointed out, we've had discussions with Homeline on this bill, and those are areas that we do not see eye to eye on. And if this bill moves forward, I am not confident that we can reach resolution on those areas. But
thank you for your testimony, you. Mr. Liljenquist. Members, we will hold questions to the end. Mr. Smith, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm a resident of Minneapolis. I'm the owner of Cornerstone Property Professionals and a licensed real estate broker. We're a small company that owns and manages our own small portfolio of less than 100 units in South Minneapolis. I've been involved in the property management business for 15 years, and I've served on the board of directors of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I would like to respectfully point out some serious concerns with the proposed legislation before you. We actively manage our properties. This is especially important because I have a large number of units in proximity to areas of our city challenged with livability crimes. I know this because I serve as the chair of the Neighborhood Crime and Safety Committee. The assignment of leases and subleasing is not our business practice. It's not our business practice because I must carefully screen our tenants. The regulatory practices in the city of Minneapolis place a heavy burden on landlords to ensure that we have crime-free facilities. Many municipalities are very active in this area of enforcement. The penalties are significant if we do not act diligently and with all vigilance. Therefore, when we have the rare occasion that a tenant abandons their unit or has been evicted, we try very hard to avoid a recurrence. It's expensive because of the lost revenues, and as a matter of good business, we want that unit reoccupied quickly. In other words, we want to mitigate the damages as a matter of course because we are losing potential revenue, and we have almost no chance of recovering the loss from the departing tenant. But if a tenant who wanted to abandon a lease or was being evicted could use this provision as written, if it was law, then we would be forced to assign the lease or sublease to a suitable tenant, for which there's no definition in the bill. My expectation is that we would end up with friends, relatives, or associates of the tenant being the assignee or sublessee, which, given the previous activity in the unit, may or may not be much of an improvement, even if they qualify based on our rental policy. I can easily imagine a scenario where I'm evicting a tenant because of narcotics activity in the unit, and the tenant assigns the lease to an associate who may continue the prior activity which initiated the original eviction. I can tell you that my local police narcotics unit and the city regulatory services would raise eyebrows at the new tenant and hand me a warning notice. And in Minneapolis, if there's a second offense at the property in 12 months, then I can have my license revoked. This provision in this bill, in conjunction with local ordinances, potentially sets me up to lose my license and put my good tenants on the street. I appreciate the author's intent is to help tenants, but this may be to the detriment of my good tenants. I urge you carefully to consider the unintended consequences of this bill so that we don't harm the livability of our properties and interfere with good management practices. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Smith. So, moving on to questions, Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't know who should answer this, but my concern is I got the same concerns with reasonable experts and suitable tenant, but what happens when the tenant normally moves out? It takes a time to prepare the property to re-rent it. Normally when folks vacate a premises, it's not suitable for somebody just to walk back in and rent it, especially if they vacate for non-payment or if they have a drug issue or that type of thing. Where does that fit into this bill as far that type of thing? Where does that fit into this bill as far as when it takes us a time or it takes that landlord a period of time to renovate that property to get it suitable to leasing? Is that damages that I can occur? Is that unreasonable in my efforts to release this before I put it back on the market?
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Bernberg, you want to answer that one? Well, why don't we? Go ahead, Mr. Bernberg.
Representative Lesch and Representative Howell, the answer to your question is those would be reasonable damages that you would have a quality claim against the tenant for.
Representative Howell? Okay, Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Lildenquist. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Go ahead, ask your question.
So it sounds like your major objection is to the subleasing portion of the bill. Would that be fair to say? I mean, it sounds like you don't like the whole thing. But I guess I'm asking, could you live with it better if it didn't have the sublease or assignment provisions in it?
Mr. Lildenquist.
Mr. Chair and members, we do oppose the bill in its entirety for the reasons that I said. We believe it undermines the value of the lease. We believe it's unnecessary because the landlords have every incentive already to mitigate damages. Certainly the assignment and sublease portion is an extremely concerning part of the bill. We would, if that language were stricken out today, we would still continue to oppose the bill in its current form.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, do you know if other states require the sublease or assignment language? And maybe it's a question for Mr. Bernberg. But it just seems that that's something that's controlled by the contract between the parties. And I don't know, you know, I think the landlord who testified made some good points about, you know, capacity of a tenant to really screen a sublessee as compared to the capacity of the landlord to really screen a new tenant for the unit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hartman, I was quite concerned about Mr. Smith's testimony, and it quite upset me because I have the district that has the most problems with this in the state, and I certainly would not be carrying a bill that's going to create problems in my neighborhoods. I've fought against it forever. His testimony is just totally off base on this whole issue of assigning to another narcotics person. It just doesn't happen. In every phase, we use, as you know, as an attorney, reasonable is the standard all over the law, and the same with suitable tenant. Now you're talking about, we constantly look at, this is more like consumer law. We, all throughout, this is not like two parties that are equal. It's kind of, you go back to, does McDonald's Corporation have the same power in the situation? Why do we do franchising law? Why do we do all kinds of things to balance power in here? And so I don't see any problem with the assignment and sublease as long as we built in the initial bill did not have that there had to be a suitable tenant. And so if they want to, you know, change the word suitable, whatever, something, but it should be something like that. The landlord can just as easily screen the person that the, it isn't like, I mean, I used to do a lot of commercial leasing law. It's not that I, as a tenant, can assign, just take somebody that I want to go in there. It has to be the landlord can screen that person just as well as they can screen somebody off the street. And so all this is saying is that they have to, if that tenant is suitable, then they shouldn't just reject it so that they can basically want, you know, say, no, you have to pay us a big fee, what, $600 or something, and then we'll forget about this and we'll lease it to somebody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I didn't really like the narcotics example either because, you know, as a former legal aid lawyer who represented tenants, that wasn't the character of the clients that I represented. I agree with you. But I do think the way it's phrased is not what you testified. I think the way it's phrased, you know, allowing a sublease or an assignment puts it in the tenant's control, not in the landlord's control. I mean, if the landlord has a duty to mitigate, then the landlord's in control of going out and getting a new tenant. And I do think the city of Minneapolis puts a pretty heavy burden on landlords to make sure that they're screening appropriately so that they don't have nuisance problems on their property. And I'm all for a duty to mitigate. I just think the sublease or assignment provision maybe takes it a step too far.
Representative Lesh, did I answer?
I don't think that was a question, was it, Representative Portman? I think move us along here rather than have every person take a bite at the same apple. So did you need an answer to your question, Representative Portman?
Mr. Chair, if Mr. Bernberg has something more
go ahead, Mr. Bernberg. If you have something more to add, go ahead.
I think so. I think the direct answer to her question is that of the 44 or so jurisdictions that have a duty to mitigate, and I checked with Mr. McDonough on this, certainly a majority do not have a requirement like this of the assignment and subleasing. And as I testified in my main testimony, that's not the crucial part of the bill. And if the landlords had the duty to mitigate without that assignment and subleasing language, I think this bill would be okay. And the language that Mr. Lilienquist and I have exchanged did not have that language in it. And so, as again, that's not the crucial part of the bill. Hopefully that answers your question.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, my last question is for you, and where is this bill going next?
This is going to Judiciary, Representative.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Scott? Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just had a question for Representative Mullery, because we used to own property in your district. And I just wondered, have you ever owned a property in your own district? Have you ever been a landlord down there in your district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, no, I haven't been a landlord in my own district.
Have you ever been a landlord?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Well, this kind of stuff is
however,
kind of frustrating.
Hold on a second here. Representative Scott, go ahead.
Thank you. This kind of stuff is very frustrating to landlords that try to do their best to provide a place for people and go to lengths that you would not believe to try to keep people in their apartment because it's very, or in their dwelling that you're renting out, because it's very expensive to turn apartments. It's very, very expensive. And so my next question would be to Mr. Lilienquist. Do you think that this bill in its current form is balanced for both the tenant and the landlord?
Mr. Lilienquist.
And if not, why? Or how so?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, no. We believe that the incidences where a tenant would be required to mitigate would be far fewer than instances where the landlord would be required to mitigate.
Mr. Scott.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 2151? Seeing none, then the chair renews the motion that House File 2151 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Members, is Representative Allen here? Representative Allen moves that House File 2151 be referred to the General Register. And Mr. Bernberg is here to be heard on this as well. Oh, there we go, 2192. Representative Allen moves that House File 2192 be referred to the General Register. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Currently, there's no specific laws regarding infirm tenants, and it is up to the landlord's discretion whether the lease can be broken or not. This bill would require landlords to allow sick tenants to break their lease with 2 months' notice. The tenant still has an obligation to pay rent during that notice period. And we have Mr. Brinberg here from Homeline that will testify. And I think you want to make one, Mr. Chair, one oral amendment. To line 210. And we want to add to the beginning of before either, add upon the death of the tenant or comma, if there is more than one tenant, comma, upon the death of all tenants, comma, and then the capital E should be a small e. That was at the suggestion of, for clarification.
It doesn't sound too clarifying, Representative Allen. In fact, it confuses me more. Because this was not submitted within 24 hours, and it sounds like it's more than just a technical change, I'll defer to the committee on whether or not there's objection to accepting this. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take the blame for this.
when one of the advocates was talking to me about the bill, for me, because originally subdivision one was immediately followed by subdivision two, that's now labeled A, it was quite clear that subdivision 2A applied to the case of the death of the tenant, but now it's been separated from its previous paragraph, if that made sense, and I just thought it would be helpful if it clarified that that particular paragraph, now labeled subdivision 2A, referred to the case in which a tenant had died.
Is there any other comments from the committee or objection to that that amendment as submitted? Hearing none, then all in favor of the amendment as stated, do I need to restate it or are we adequate? All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Okay, Representative Allen, go ahead. Your bill is amended. Representative Allen, did you want us to hear from Mr. Bernberg?
Well, I can add that this bill allows renters who have a physician-certified medical condition, illness, or disability that hinders their ability to remain in their current housing situation the opportunity to end their lease with a 2-month notice if they must move to an appropriate type of medically assisted housing unit, and then the statute gives examples of those types of facilities. So there, I think the opposition so far has been centered around that potential for abuse, and so we would argue that the certification from the physician, that's one aspect of it, but it also requires that the individual be eligible for admission to one of these types of alternative assisted living or nursing home, hospice care, and so I'm not seeing the potential for abuse here.
Thank you.
Representative
Allen.
The testifier can talk more about
it. Go ahead, Mr. Bernberg.
Representative Lesch, Chairman Lesch, members of the committee, thank you. I'm still Paul Bernberg. I still work for Homeland as I did 10 minutes ago and still do the same work. Briefly on the amendment, just so people understand, it's meant just to make a new statute clear. It's not of any substance. It's just for clarity. Currently, Minnesota law provides 4 situations in which a tenant can unilaterally break his lease. They are constructive eviction. That is a situation where the place is wrecked by a tornado or that kind of thing, so it's unlivable. Situation 2 is the death of the tenant. There's another statute that allows the tenant to, the new tenant, which is the estate of the old tenant, where they all died, to terminate the lease on 2 months' notice. With a tornado, you can just terminate it right away when the place is unlivable. Thirdly is a federal law. This used to be called the Soldiers and Sailors Act. Now it's the Civil Service Members Civil Relief Act, which allows a member of the armed forces who's called out of town on orders to give a 30-day notice to cut short his lease. And lastly, there's Minnesota Statute 504B.205, which allows termination on the payment of a 1-month buyout fee for domestic abuse situation. All 4 of these situations have one thing in common. The tenant, it happened to the tenant. The tenant didn't decide to do it. The proposed bill would add a 5th category of the tenant who has become so ill that she needs to move to someplace else for medical care and would give her the right to give the same 2 months' notice that her estate could give if she sadly died. As Representative Allen said, this sort of situation comes up and it causes a lot of stress for families. That we passed out an example of testimony given before Karen Clark's committee live by Penny Hested, where the tenant's got a 10-month lease, gets ill, in that case a stroke, now needs to go to someplace like a nursing home for permanent care, and the tenant is now between a rock and a hard place. Do I pay 10 months of rent and go where I need to go, or do I stay and not get the care I need, and which could be dire, essentially a draconian choice, and it puts a lot of stress on the tenant. usually puts a lot of stress on the tenant's children, adult children who are trying to take care of that person. And this is designed to give this tenant and that family the same sort of out that with death. Not an immediate out, but on 2 months' notice. I will point out that this is not an excuse for a tenant to say, I'm kind of feeling ill. What's required is first a physician certification, not just any certification from a medical person, but a physician certification that the tenant needs to move to one of these special listed places, which are all defined in other statutes and require and involve specialized medical care. So it's, just to give you an example from my own family, toward the end of her life, my mother got pancreatic cancer. She was living in another state, so this law wouldn't have applied. But I mean, pancreatic cancer is not a good thing, but this would not have helped, this statute would not have applied to her until as the cancer progressed. At one point she got a stroke, and then she needed essentially 24-hour care. And that's when it would have kicked in. Not even, it's not just because she was literally deathly ill with pancreatic cancer, but because she needed this, at that point a physician would have certified that she needed 24-hour care and needed to go someplace else. So again, we urge you to pass the bill. And I'd stand for questions or as the chair desires.
Thank you. Todd Liljenquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, Todd Liljenquist, Multi-Housing Association. We're obviously very sympathetic to the issue that tenants are in this situation. This already largely happens without regulation, where the landlord works with the tenants on an individualized case-by-case basis and gets them into the facility that is appropriate. One thing I need to point out is the scope of this bill is broad and similar in scope to the domestic violence statute, which we've been working with legal aid on for the past 6 months, and we're still not to the point where we have an agreeable bill. And we believe that this deserves thoughtful consideration as well. Some things I should point out about the broadness of the proposal. The housing programs covered, for example, any residents licensed or certified by Department of Health or Human Services includes chemical detox programs, which I don't think is what necessarily anybody would think of as what this bill would normally cover. And physician, the definition that they refer to in the bill as physician is someone who is licensed, registered, or regulated by the Board of Medical Practice under Chapter 147, and that includes acupuncturists, athletic trainers, naturopaths, and midwives. And there's actually no proof that there's actually occupancy available at any of the facilities. So someone could use this and say that they need to move to another facility, but there's no proof that that assisted living or nursing home has any beds available or any rooms available at that time. So they could get out of their lease but have no place to go. And one final point, just the vagueness of some of the language. No longer able to live without assistance with instrumental activities of daily living or personal activities of daily living, and I'm not sure I can articulate what that means. So, as we said in the last committee, if this bill continues to move forward, we'd like to be able to provide input. We haven't had that opportunity to this point.
Thank you. Lawrence McDonough, you still here to testify on this?
I'll cede my time.
Okay, thank you. So then, questions from members for the testifiers of the bill's author, Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and to the author. The point the testifier was just making about the reference to a physician on 2.7 to 2.9, I actually had kind of a different take on that language, which is, you know, without commenting on the bill as a whole, but why would you restrict it to a physician? It seems like now the direction we're moving is, as you know, advanced practice nurses and physician assistants are kind of doing a lot of these same functions, and to actually have to go and find a physician, even if it didn't include, and I'm not sure that it does include all those other people, you know, the term physician does not include an acupuncturist, et cetera, even though they are under the same practice act, but I think it's too restrictive, perhaps, in cutting out other practitioners who make decisions all the time about whether people go into nursing homes and stuff.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. And that is something to take a look at. I don't know, maybe there was some reason why some of these facilities require insurance, and I don't know if that's for, you know, for eligibility for it to be admitted. Mm-hmm. So, but I, that, and that's something if it's too broad, I mean, I don't, if that's true that this is going to include a treatment center, which is, you know, temporary, or then I'm willing to make it more restrictive. That's not a problem. I object that the characterization that I wouldn't work with the opponents because they never came to visit me, so I never had that opportunity, and I didn't know that I knew there was some objection, but we were working on it, but if it was that serious, I would hope that you would come in and talk to me about that. So I'm willing to work with the opponents on making sure that this language is not overly broad, because that's not my intent, that there should be subject to abuse.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you. And as you work on it, I think there are also, if you decide to go forward, you should also clarify that the note cannot be from a physician or a licensed practical nurse or whatever. It is Chair Liebling's area, but affiliated with the facility that they're moving into. You don't want a situation where the doc from the nursing home that they're going to says, yeah, they need to come here. So I think you need I think this needs more work on a number of levels.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been through the move of a parent to a facility three times or four times, I forget, in various levels of care and whatnot. And there are actually some really established procedures for that to happen. And a social worker sometimes gets, if it follows a hospitalization, the social worker is mandated to get involved in making that assessment and whatnot. And so what I would suggest is that you talk to people in the industry about what the procedure is for admitting someone, because you can't just walk up to an assisted living place and say that you want to be there. They actually have standards for admitting people, and so whatever that decision process is, seems like it would be the appropriate one to work into this. You wouldn't have to reinvent anything then.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I don't know, to the author or the person from Homeland or anybody up there at the table can answer this, maybe. If the landlord finds out later that this was kind of a ruse and they just moved in with their daughter or their son or whatever, it's not into one of these facilities, is there any recourse for the landlord then if this was done, you know, and this program was taken advantage of?
Representative Allen?
Mr. Chair, not in this statute, no. I mean, because this statute relieves the individual. Once they satisfy the statutory requirements, they would be relieved of liability.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Allen, do you have any sense of how often this happens? I mean, we've got this testimony that was handed out about someone who this happened to, but I'm kind of thinking that, you know, I just want to know how often it happens. I mean, we're crafting a solution to something that I'm sure it's not just one person, but, you know, sometimes we've got, you know, bad cases can make bad law, and I wouldn't want to legislate around just a very small number of people.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'll let the testifier answer that, but I wanted to briefly say that there is a legal need for it, where it was earlier in a different community, and I think I've heard criticism that this bill is not needed because landlords operate in good faith, especially when somebody is ill. But really, what happens is that under that may be the case, but the individual tenant's not relieved of liability. They would have to enter into a sublease situation, and it adds a further burden. And if something goes wrong with that sublease, ultimately that tenant's going to be liable. So,
Mr. Berber.
Chairman Lesch and Representative Liebling, we don't have at Homeline, you know, careful like Gallup polling on this, but we get a call or two of this a week. on our hotline. And, of course, we don't hear from all tenants in all situations. My guess is that you're talking about, you know, 1,000 or so a year in Minnesota. I mean, it's a relative. I mean, thankfully, it doesn't happen that often. It happens less frequently than people dying. It happens less frequently than people being the victims of domestic abuse. But, you know, maybe a third of the people live in our tenants, and you can, you know, a fraction of them end up in this sort of illness. So it's not a solution for three people. It's a solution for a good number of people, but not tens of thousands a year.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, but the question isn't how many people have to move out of an apartment because they are ill. The question is how often are they in a situation where they ask the landlord to cut them a break because they're ill, and the landlord says no.
Okay.
Because that's the situation. So when you're getting those calls, are those all calls where people have tried to work it out and been rejected, or are they calls where they're calling for advice in the general situation?
Mr. Berber.
Representative Levine, our experience is that in the vast majority of those cases, the landlord said, this is a paraphrase, but I'm going to hold you to the lease. I will try to mitigate. He may not use the word mitigate, but I will try to rent your unit, but if I fail, you're on the hook. Our experience is that a relatively small minority of landlords just say, fine, you're off the hook.
Thank you. And finally, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier and Representative Allen, I just would be concerned that something like this might invite landlords not to want to rent to older people or possibly people with disabilities, because they basically their word isn't going to be good if something happens, you know. And have you thought about that at all? And I just wonder if we aren't creating a worse situation with something like this.
No, it's illegal. Representative Liebling, first, as to the, you're talking about discrimination against people who are either elderly or disabled. If they're disabled and that sort of discrimination takes place, that's illegal under current law. If the discrimination is merely based on their age, it's legal. But I don't think you'd see it much, essentially for precisely the same answer I gave before, which is that it happens in numerical a lot, but it's a relatively small fraction, thank God, of the elderly who within the year lease have this kind of stroke event. So you're balancing the fact that occasionally, and there's six or seven states, I think, that have a law like this where it seems to be working fine, occasionally you're going to lose a tenant mid-lease with a two-month notice, you know, maybe 2 months in, so you lose 8 months out of 12. But you're balancing that against the fact that, for the most part, elderly tenants actually are good tenants. They don't play their stereo loud. They don't have teenage children. They don't have all the things that younger tenants seem to do. So I think in the real world, landlords, even though they legally could discriminate against the elderly under current law, I don't think they would.
Any other questions for the testifiers? Is there any other, Representative Scott?
Thank you. We're just trying to make some sense of the statute, Mr. Chair, on 147 and that definition of physician, because I know both Mr. Liljequist and Representative Liebling are both attorneys, and I'm trying to find an actual definition of physician, and this references the entire section of 147, and that is like pages long, and I don't see a definite definition of what a physician is, but it has all this. I don't see the definition. I think that needs to be addressed. Maybe that cross references needs to be a little bit more specific if you want it to really mean physician, you know, in terms of what we think. So it's not an acupuncturist or it's not, you know, an herbalist or whatever. Okay.
With an herbalist. Mr. Chair, I agree, but we need to look at that.
And, Representative Scott, I'm going to testify for about 30 seconds on this. This essentially is my fault. I drafted this. The original suggestion had no definition of physician. I tried to find one. It's actually very difficult to find one in the statutes and the rules. I think Mr. Liljequist has pointed out that this effort's better than nothing, but it's not as good as something better.
Sounds like a Yogi Berra quote. Anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 2192 as amended? Okay, seeing none, then Representative Allen renews her motion, the House File 2192 as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, can I ask you a question?
Go ahead, Representative Portman.
Why did the previous bill go to Judiciary and this bill didn't?
Yeah, the
I guess I was under the presumption this one was going to Judiciary too. Maybe Representative Hellstrom can help.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the other one had a legal responsibility to mitigate damages, and so we consulted on this one with nonpartisan staff because we thought it was a close call. And so it's a close call.
Well, Mr. Chair,
members,
I don't know if Representative Allen would rather fix the bill in Representative Hellstrom's committee than on the House floor. Sometimes that can be a better place to do work. Or if you want to fix it up on the House floor, if you're happy being on the General Register, we can leave it there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, I'm working. We're going to work together on this, so to make sure that it's in the, we come to some agreement. Or okay.
Well, should we lay the bill over Representative Allen here rather than send it to Judiciary, and then once you got it cleaned up,
Mr. Chair, it did go through. It went through housing policy. It did pass, so do we have more time, right? I'm okay with that.
I'm not, Mr. Chair, advocating to take it off the General Register. I'm just saying that amendments on the House floor are not always smooth and easy, and amendments in committee tend to be a little bit better.
So, Mr. Chair, I would ask
Rips of Allen.
I would ask that it be
Laid over
and then come back, because
okay.
There is time to do that.
Representative Allen moves reconsideration of the motion, moving into the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Chair lays over House File 2192 as amended. Thank you for your cooperation, Representative Allen.
Thank you.
And to the testifiers. Everybody's happy. Representative Scott, did you have... my motivation in this committee is to make sure everyone's happy. So.
All right.
I know, but it'll work out between now and then. Members, the next committee is tomorrow morning at 8:15 a.m. There being no other business before the committee tonight, committee is adjourned.